Are governments of the world withholding dramatic evidence or even proof that UFOs exist as a serious reality? The question has been asked repeatedly since flying saucers made headline news throughout the world in 1947. The official denials have given rise to the suspicion that we are being told less than the truth and that a wide-scale cover-up is in operation. Official investigations into unidentified flying objects in comparatively recent times began in 1933, when, according to contemporary newspaper reports, mysterious unmarked aircraft appeared over Scandinavia and, to a lesser extent, the U.S. and Britain. Often seen flying in hazardous weather conditions, which would have grounded conventional aircraft of the period, the ghost aircraft, as they were called, frequently circled low, projecting powerful searchlights onto the ground. Another puzzling feature was that although engine noises accompanied the sightings, the aircraft sometimes described low-level maneuvers in complete silence. Researcher John Keel has cataloged the ghost aircraft sightings of this period and believes that no nation on Earth had the resources to mount such an operation at that time. He also points out the similarity between the sightings in Scandinavia and those reported from the U.S. and Britain at the time. Keel cites some reports from London, one of which refers to an unidentified aircraft seen flying over central London on the 1st of February 1934 for a period of 2 hours. The Times reported the following day that from the sound of the engines, the plane was a large one, and that its altitude was sufficiently low for its course to be traced by its lights. The Air Ministry knew nothing about the aircraft, and inquiries at a number of civil airfields around London drew a blank. 4 months later, two unidentified aircraft were seen and heard circling low over London late on the night of the 11th of June. According to the Times the following day, the Air Ministry stated that although night flying was frequently practiced by RAF machines, and several were up last night, service pilots were forbidden by regulations to fly over London at less than 5,000 feet. The identity of the machines in question was not officially known. According to the late journalist Frank Edwards, the British allegedly set up a small organization in 1943, headed by a Lieutenant General Massey, to investigate sightings of small, apparently remote-controlled devices which were being reported by Allied air crews. Rumors had spread that the Germans or Japanese had introduced a new weapon designed to interfere with the ignition systems of bombers, but since the Foo Fighters, as they were nicknamed, never engaged in hostile action, many flight crews became convinced that the objects were some type of psychological warfare device. Officially terminated the following year, the Massey Project, as it was allegedly codenamed, determined that the Foo Fighters were not German, and that the Germans had themselves set up a similar organization to investigate sightings then being reported by Luftwaffe pilots. Reports of Foo Fighters were not restricted to the European theater of operations. In 1946, over 2,000 sightings of ghost rockets and other unidentified flying objects were reported by witnesses in Finland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, followed by reports from Portugal, Tangier, Italy, Greece, and India. The ghost rockets, so-called because they often look like rocket-shaped objects with fiery trails, sometimes performed fantastic maneuvers, crossing the sky at tremendous velocity, diving and climbing, and at other times moving in a leisurely manner. There were also reports of landings and crashes. An overwhelming majority of the reports came from Sweden, causing consternation not only in official circles in that country, but also at the U.S. Embassy in Stockholm. A hitherto secret Department of State telegram from the embassy, dated the 11th of July 1946, provides a dramatic example of the situation at that time. For some weeks, there have been numerous reports of strange rocket-like missiles being seen in Swedish and Finnish skies. During past few days, reports of such objects being seen have greatly increased. A member of legation saw one Tuesday afternoon. One landed on beach near Stockholm same afternoon without causing any damage, and according to press, fragments are now being studied by military authorities. Local scientist on first inspection stated it contained organic substance resembling carbide. Defense staff last night issued communique listing various places where missiles had been observed and urging public report all mysterious sound and light phenomena. Press this afternoon announces one such missile fell in Stockholm suburb 2:30 this afternoon. Missile observed by member legation made no sound and seemed to be falling rapidly to earth when observed. No sound of explosion followed, however. Military attaché is investigating through Swedish channels and has been promised results of Swedish observations. Swedes profess ignorance as to origin, character, or purpose of missiles, but state definitely they are not launched by Swedes. Eyewitness reports state missiles came in from southerly direction proceeding to northwest. 6 units, Atlantic Fleet, under Admiral Hewitt, arrived Stockholm this morning. If missiles are of Soviet origin, as generally believed, some reports say they are launched from Estonia, purpose might be political, to intimidate Swedes in connection with Soviet pressure on Sweden being built up in connection with current loan negotiations, or to offset supposed increase in our military prestige in Sweden resulting from the naval visit and recent bikini tests, or both. On the 13th of August, 1946, the New York Times reported that the Swedish General Staff today described the situation as extremely dangerous, and it is obvious that Sweden no longer is going to tolerate such violations. The violations continued, however, and it is revealing that Sweden chose not to retaliate against the Soviet Union. Speculation centered on the theory that the Russians were testing V-2 type rockets with the aid of captured German scientists and engineers, and that the Swedish General Staff summoned urgent assistance from the United States and Great Britain. Lieutenant General James Doolittle, the U.S. Army Air Force intelligence expert with specialized knowledge of long-distance bombing techniques, arrived in Stockholm together with General David Sarnoff, an intelligence expert in aerial warfare, and the two men were consulted by Colonel C.R. Kempf, the Chief of Swedish Defense. Sarnoff was later quoted as saying that the objects reported were neither mythological nor meteorological, but were real missiles. But then came the cover-up. On the 22nd of August, 1946, the Daily Telegraph stated, "The discussion of the flight of rockets over Scandinavia has been dropped in the Norwegian newspaper since Wednesday. On that day, the Norwegian General Staff issued a memorandum to the press asking it not to make any mention of the appearance of rockets over Norwegian territory, but to pass on all reports to the Intelligence Department of the High Command. In Sweden, the ban is limited to any mention of where the rockets have been seen to land or explode." On the 23rd of August, 1946, the British Foreign Office stated that the English radar experts, having returned from Sweden, had submitted secret reports to the British government on the origin of the rockets. One of the scientists to examine the reports was R.V. Jones, Director of Intelligence of Britain's Air Staff at the time, as well as scientific advisor to the Secret Intelligence Service. Professor Jones remains unimpressed by the reports he examined, attributing them to initial sightings of 2 unusually bright meteors, which were clearly visible in daylight. One of these led to many reports almost simultaneously from a wide area of Sweden. The subsequent wave of sightings was caused simply by overenthusiastic observers in the prevalent Cold War climate, he believed. Although no crashed missiles were ever found, one observer claimed to have seen objects fall from one of the ghost rockets and had collected the pieces. These were passed by the Swedish General Staff to the other Director of Intelligence on the Air Staff and were eventually analyzed at the Royal Aircraft Establishment, Farnborough. In great excitement, the scientists reported that one of the fragments contained over 98% of an unknown element. Jones asked the head of the chemical department at the RAE if they had tested for carbon. "There was something of an explosion at the other end of the telephone," said Jones. "Carbon would not have shown up in any of the standard tests, but one had only to look at the material, as Charles Frank and I had done, to see that it was a lump of coke." Professor Jones may have been justified in his skepticism about the sample as well as the purported origin of the missiles, but he was evidently mistaken in his outright rejection of the reports, which continued to cause grave concern. The U.S. Department of State had upgraded their communications with the embassy in Stockholm to top secret, and the following is the text of a telegram from the embassy dated the 29th of August, 1946. "While over 800 reports have been received and new reports come daily, Swedes still have no tangible evidence. Full details of reports thus far received have been forwarded to Washington by our military and naval attachés. My own source is personally convinced some foreign power is actually experimenting over Sweden, and he guesses it is Russia." The Daily Telegraph published a photograph of one of the missiles in its issue of the 6th of September 1946, taken near Stockholm by Erik Reuterswärd, who reported it to the Swedish General Staff. Together with Allied experts, the Swedish authorities came to the conclusion that the projectile was within the flame or trail rather than ahead of it. This supports the theory that a new method of propulsion is being used in these weapons, stated the Telegraph. Something unprecedented had been haunting the airspace of Scandinavia, and in October 1946, the Swedish government announced the results of its official inquiry. Swedish military authorities said today that they had been unable to discover, after 4 months of investigation, the origin or nature of the ghost rockets that have been flying over Sweden since May. A special communique declared that 80% of 1,000 reports on the rockets could be attributed to celestial phenomena, but that radar had detected some 200 objects which cannot be the phenomena of nature or products of the imagination, nor can be referred to as Swedish airplanes. The reports added, however, that the objects were not the V-type bombs used by the Germans in the closing days of the war. In an interview in London on the 5th of September 1946, the Greek Prime Minister, M. Tsaldaris, said that on the 1st of September, a number of projectiles had been seen over Macedonia and Salonika. The following year, Greece's leading scientist, Professor Paul Santorini, was supplied by the Greek army with a team of engineers to investigate what were believed to be Russian missiles flying over Greece. On the 24th of February, 1967, he gave a lecture to the Greek Astronautical Society, broadcast on Athens Radio, during which he revealed the results of the Greek investigation into the ghost rockets. "We soon established that they were not missiles, but before we could do any more, the army, after conferring with foreign officials, ordered the investigation stopped. Foreign scientists flew to Greece for secret talks with me." This statement was personally verified by the respected American researcher Raymond Fowler, who had written to Santorini to check on the accuracy of the newspaper quotes attributed to him following the broadcast. The professor confirmed that a world blanket of secrecy surrounded the UFO question because, among other reasons, the authorities were unwilling to admit the existence of a force against which we had no possibility of defense. If the late American journalist Frank Edwards is to be believed, British government research into mysterious flying objects began as early as 1943 with Lieutenant General Massey's small organization in the War Office to investigate Foo Fighters. Edwards claimed that this information was given to him by a Ministry of Defense source in 1966, but it has been disputed by Air Marshal Sir Victor Goddard, who was appointed first Deputy Director of Air Intelligence to the Air Ministry in 1935. "To the best of my knowledge," he states, "there has never been any official study made." Edwards claimed that the Massey project had been instigated to some extent by the reports of a spy who was in reality a double agent, working under the direction of the mayor of Cologne. Edwards was told by his source that the research project was terminated in 1944. "Perhaps it is only a coincidence," he wrote, "that the double agent was exposed and executed in the spring of 1944. On the 14th of October 1954, Flight Lieutenant Salandin of No. 604 County of Middlesex Squadron, Royal Auxiliary Air Force, took off at 4:15 p.m. from his base at RAF North Weald in Essex in a Meteor MK-8. The weather was perfect. "When I was at about 16,000 feet, I saw a whole lot of contrails, possibly at about 30 to 40,000 feet, over the North Foreland. Through the middle of the trails, I saw three objects which I thought were airplanes, but they weren't trailing. They came down through the middle of that towards Southend and then headed toward me. When they got to within a certain distance, two of them went off to my port side, one gold and one silver, and the third object came straight toward me and close to within a few hundred yards, almost filling the windscreen. Then it went off toward my port side. I tried to turn around to follow, but it had gone. It was saucer-shaped, with a bun on top and a bun underneath, and was silvery and metallic. There were no portholes, flames, or anything." Prior to flying meteors and vampires, Jimmy Salandin told me that he had gained experience in a number of other aircraft, including 100 hours in the Spitfire MK-16. This aircraft is still flying. Salandin only regrets that there was not sufficient time to trigger the gun camera button. but his memory of the sighting remains vivid. "I haven't found a satisfactory explanation for what I saw," he told me, "but I know what I saw." 3 weeks after Flight Lieutenant Saladin's sighting, the War Office admitted that it was completely baffled by strange formations of blips tracked on radar moving from east to west. A thorough check revealed that they could not have been caused by aircraft. From late October to early November 1954, there were 6 sightings of the unidentified targets, which appeared from nowhere, usually at midday, flying at a height of 12,000 feet. First seen by a civilian radar scientist, they were subsequently plotted by all the radar sets in the area on both fine and cloudy mornings. A War Office spokesman described the formations as follows. "We cannot say what they are. They first appear in a U, or badly shaped hairpin formation. After a time, they converge into 2 parallel lines and then take a Z formation before disappearing. They are invisible to the human eye, but on the radar screen they appear as lots and lots of dots formed by between 40 and 50 echoes. They cover an area in the sky miles long and miles wide. Every time they have been seen, they followed the same pattern. It was always around midday. We have checked and found that our sets are not faulty. We are still maintaining a watch. All our sets in the area have picked them up." The location of the radar trackings was not identified, and one witness said that he had been given very high-level orders to maintain the utmost secrecy. "And even if I did know what they are," he added, "I am too worried myself to say anything." The Air Ministry seemed anxious to play down the incidents, pointing out that there are many objects, such as meteorological balloons, experimental aircraft, carrier pigeons with metal rings on their legs, and even toy kites, which could generate an image on radar. But the trained radar specialist said that none of these would produce such regular and repeated patterns. By 1954, defense chiefs in Britain were convinced that a problem existed, even if they were not prepared to admit as much in public. In April of 1955, the British Air Ministry announced that the results of a 5-year investigation into flying saucers by the Royal Air Force had been submitted to high-ranking officers, but that it was never to be revealed to the public for security reasons. In view of the ministry's oft-repeated statement that UFOs do not constitute a threat to the nation's security, this was a curious announcement, and it provoked Major Patrick Wall, MP, to ask the Undersecretary of State for Air, George Ward, to confirm whether he proposed to publish a report. Ward's reply failed to address the question. "Reports of flying saucers, as well as other abnormal objects in the sky, are investigated as they come in, but there has been no formal inquiry. About 90% of the reports have been found to relate to meteors, balloons, flares, and many other objects. The fact that the other 10% are unexplained need be attributed to nothing more sinister than lack of data." On the 4th of April, 1957, an unidentified target was tracked at RAF West Frew on the west coast of Scotland, and radar stations throughout Britain were ordered by RAF intelligence to keep a 24-hour watch for the object. Wing Commander Walter Whitworth, commanding officer at West Frew, was quoted as saying, "I have been ordered by the Air Ministry to say nothing about the object. I am not allowed to reveal its position, course, and speed. From the moment of picking it up, it is well within our area. It was an object of some substance, quite definitely not a freak. No mistake could have been made by the Ministry of Supply civilians operating the sets. They are fully qualified and experienced officers." Wing Commander Whitworth said later that the matter had been taken extremely seriously by the Air Ministry, where a spokesman said that until their experts had a full report, no detailed statement would be issued. 9 weeks after the West Frew report, the Reynolds News claimed that the Air Ministry conducted top-secret research into the UFO phenomenon at one of its offices in Northumberland Avenue, London. The report stated that on the 9th floor of what was formerly the Hotel Metropole, a top-secret room existed, number 801, where all reports of UFOs were collected and studied by experts. In the 10 years during which the Air Ministry had been analyzing the reports, 1947 to 57, a ministry spokesman was quoted as saying they had something like 10,000 sightings on file, and that although many reports had been cleared up, there were some which could not be explained. "Nobody in the know," he admitted, is prepared to say that all reports about these mystery objects are nonsense. The interior of room 801 was never seen by unauthorized persons. A large map of the British Isles hung on one wall, the report continued, and on it were literally thousands of colored pins, with the heaviest concentration appearing to be over the Norwich area. At airfields all over Britain, fighter planes were kept ready to intercept, and if necessary, to engage any UFO within combat range. Gordon Creighton, the editor of Flying Saucer Review, had been an intelligence officer at Northumberland Avenue during the period in question, so I asked him if he could substantiate the story in any way, although he was not involved with the Air Ministry. I was on the next floor to the department that dealt with UFOs, he told me. There was only one floor above us. The floor was the Deputy Directorate of Intelligence, technical, so everybody that went up in the lift above us was from that department. There weren't any other departments on that floor, but I and one or two other people in my department used to have fun when we were going up or down in the lift with a bunch of these chaps talking about UFOs. Sightings in the United Kingdom over the next few years declined considerably, and newspaper reports became correspondingly less frequent, leading to a suspicion in some quarters that they were being censored by officialdom. Journalist Roger Muirfield, for example, wrote in 1960, "Although I cannot explain why the truth is being suppressed, I am certain it is merely a rearguard action that is being fought, consciously or subconsciously, by those who are responsible for the molding of public opinion. Somewhere, I am certain, the penny has dropped, but the public must not be told." In 1964, the Air Ministry, Admiralty, and War Office were unified into the new Ministry of Defense, largely at the instigation of Lord Mountbatten, who was Chief of the Defense Staff at the time. The Air Ministry became the Air Force Department, within which was a secretariat called S4 Air, that had, among other jobs, the task of handling complaints from the public about alleged low-flying infringements, as well as dealing with reports of UFO sightings by members of the public. Another department within the central staffs, Defense Secretariat 8, handled similar tasks at this time. The newly formed DS-8 took over the responsibilities of Secretariat 6. And the significant change was that instead of belonging to the Air Force Department, it now belonged to the Secretary of State, the former head of DS-8, Ralph Noyes, explained to me. He went on to say, "It gave it a certain authority and was one of Dennis Healey's means of trying to get all information about all three services collated at the central staffs. The old S6, the old S4, had had the same uneasy division between them about these reports from the public that the new DS-8 and the new S4 Air had, and that persisted. It was very frustrating to me and the head of that other division. We would sometimes say to each other in the corridor, 'We've got something here. Is it yours? Is it mine?' And if it looked very clearly like a low-flying complaint, something that suddenly frightened a lot of sheep in a valley of whales, and was pretty clearly a lightning interceptor jet or something, then it was for S4 to deal with. And I used to sigh with relief and let S4 get on with it, and find out from the unit if a lightning had been outside the designated low-flying area. But often enough, stuff came to DS-8, because S4, very often having received it at the main point of entry, said, 'Nothing to do with us, this isn't low flying. This wasn't an exercise. There's nothing here that we've got any responsibility to the public for. Over to you.' So DS-8 tended to get a lot of reports, quite often through S4, sometimes directly from the public." The prime task of dealing with UFO reports and replying to the public, however, lay with S4 at that time, as Ralph Noyes has confirmed. "Does this mean," I asked him, "that you didn't necessarily see the best material?" "It certainly does," replied Noyes, "if by best material you mean close encounters on the ground." 1967 was one of the busiest years for sightings ever recorded in the United Kingdom, and the Ministry of Defense was inundated with reports. One of the more impressive cases took place at 11:30 a.m. on the 28th of April, when 8 Coast Guards at Brixham, Devon, reported a huge cone-shaped object hovering at about 15,000 feet. The Coast Guards observed the object through 25-power binoculars mounted on a tripod and noticed that it appeared to be revolving. Coast Guard Brian Jenkins reported, "I could see that the thing was shaped like a cone with the sharp end pointing upward. It was white and shining brightly. It seemed as if it was made of glass or highly polished metal. Near the bottom there was a triangular-shaped opening or door with a white rim on the top that reflected a lot of sunlight. The bottom was crinkled, very white, and seemed to consist of strips of metal hanging down. Flight Lieutenant David Smith, senior RAF controller at Plymouth, confirmed that he had received the report from Jenkins and had sent it to the Ministry of Defense. Asked about the aircraft, Smith replied, "We would know about any aircraft in the area and don't know about one going up to see the cone. There was no tracking of UFO on our radar." A spokesman for the Ministry of Defense suggested that the object may have been something like the reflection of car headlights or some sort of meteorological phenomena. "I don't know anything about the plane that flew near it. I can't comment further." The Coast Guard Station Commander, Harry Johnson, was not impressed with these explanations. "It's silly to suggest that well-trained and experienced observers thought a reflection of car headlights was a UFO," he said. "Remember, this was about midday. Our head office told us not to discuss this, but did not tell us why. I don't see the harm in it, and if there is any, our superior officers should have told us." In the small hours of the 6th of November, 1967, on a section of the road between Avon and Sopley, Hampshire, driver Carl Farlow found that the lights of his diesel truck had suddenly and unaccountably failed. As he pulled up, he observed a glowing 15 feet wide egg-shaped UFO, which moved slowly across the road from the right, moved slowly to the left, then accelerated and disappeared. The object made a sound like a refrigerator and gave off a smell like a drill boring through wood. Before the object disappeared, a Jaguar car came from the opposite direction and its lights and engine stalled. "Our vehicles were stationary 25 to 30 yards from each other," Farlow reported. "The object was in between us. It glowed in the most beautiful green color I have ever seen. It was like nothing on earth. I sat in the cab petrified. I don't want ever to experience anything like that again. This was no hallucination." After the object had gone, the driver of the Jaguar, a veterinary surgeon, suggested to Farlow that they phone the police from a nearby call box, also with its lights out. The police arrived shortly afterward. The following day, both men were taken to Christ Church Police Station and were interviewed by a man from the Ministry of Defense. Later that day, Farlow was driven back to the site by the police in order to collect his belongings from the truck and noticed a group of people investigating the site with instruments, a bulldozer leveling the ground, and a man repainting the telephone booth. A week later, Farlow observed that a 200-foot stretch of the road had been completely resurfaced, as if to cover all traces of evidence. As Hillary Evans, a leading authority, comments, 400 pounds sterling of electrical damage had been done to the truck. Nothing is known about the damage to the Jaguar. This detailed case is rich in unanswered questions. Much of it suggests a military device of some kind, but if so, the authorities have successfully kept it secret for a further 16 years. Whether man-made or extraterrestrial, the Avon UFO was clearly capable of exerting some very remarkable physical effects. There have been a number of cases where Ministry of Defense personnel are alleged to have warned witnesses and investigators not to publicize or pursue the matter, although the evidence is far from conclusive in the majority of cases that the MOD was actually responsible. Following a UFO sighting that was reported in a local newspaper in the late summer of 1974, three of the four witnesses were visited one evening by a man from the government who asked them to sign a printed form agreeing not to discuss the incident with the national media. "The man just turned up at my house, showed his identification, and asked to come in," the principal witness told me in 1986. "There were three of us that had the sighting, and my little girl. He was not interested in her. Just myself, my ex-wife, and my friend, who sadly to say is dead." The interviews lasted a total of about 2 hours. We were interviewed at length separately. We were shown different drawings of various types of UFOs. Incidentally, they were printed. In fact, all the paperwork was printed and not typewritten. The paper certainly had codes which didn't mean anything to either of us. We were then told we had seen a UFO, but should not tell or inform the national media. He then produced three documents, and we each signed, saying that we would not. He then put his papers into a black case. I would prefer if my name was left out of it, as I fear reprisal after signing the document. What does the Ministry of Defense have to say about the incident? That's absolute nonsense, David Ross of the MOD's Secretariat AS2 told me. To whom else did he report the sighting? It certainly wouldn't come from the MOD. I mean, we do on occasion visit witnesses and ask if they can describe what they've seen. On no account has anyone in the Ministry of Defense the authorization to say, don't discuss it with anyone else. Despite David Ross's genuinely expressed assurances, I am unable to accept that the MOD Secretariat knows everything that goes on. I very much doubt that the AS-2, the successor to DS-8, receives military sighting reports of any significance. Nor would AS-2 necessarily be aware of clandestine investigations carried out by the police special branch, which liaises closely with M-15, or even the defense intelligence staff. Compartmentation of intelligence would take care of that. The now-proven involvement of America's Central Intelligence, National Security and Defense Intelligence Agencies, as well as other official bodies in UFO investigations, all of whom liaise with their British counterparts, leads me to suspect that covert inquiries are carried out in Britain, with few being aware of the fact. If I am mistaken, the only alternative is that people are using false government ID cards and documents to gain access to witnesses' homes, persuade them that they represent the government, and discourage further dissemination of their reports. This may well be true in some instances. In 1981, I interviewed a man who claimed to have been working at Heathrow Air Traffic Control in September 1966 when a UFO was observed during the small hours. All personnel in the control tower saw the object hovering at low altitude above the airport at a time when there were no aircraft movements. The UFO was tracked on radar and its speed at departure was clocked at 3,000 miles per hour. The Ministry of Defense was notified, and investigators allegedly arrived on the scene and told the witnesses that they had seen nothing, threatening them with charges under the Official Secrets Act if they revealed the sighting publicly. In response to an inquiry to the MOD, I received the following statement. As you are no doubt aware, the Official Secrets Act applies to the release of information obtained in the course of official duty. However, our records show no occasions on which the Official Secrets Act has been specifically applied to the handling of UFO reports. Secrecy also surrounded the sighting of an unidentified object by air traffic controllers at Gatwick Airport on the 16th of August 1978. The controllers definitely saw something, an airport spokesman was quoted as saying, but they have clammed up over exactly what it was. One of the most sensational UFO events ever reported by military personnel is alleged to have occurred in Rendlesham Forest. Leaving aside later inconsistencies, the most impressive evidence has been provided by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Halt, U.S. Air Force Deputy Base Commander at Woodbridge at the time. His official report was sent to the Ministry of Defense on the 13th of January, 1981. Early in the morning of the 27th of December, 1980, approximately 0300L, two USAF security police patrolmen saw unusual lights outside the back gate at RAF Woodbridge. Thinking an aircraft might have crashed or been forced down, they called for permission to go outside the gate to investigate. The on-duty flight chief responded and allowed three patrolmen to proceed on foot. The individuals reported seeing a strange glowing object in the forest. The object was described as being metallic in appearance and triangular in shape, approximately 2 to 3 meters across the base and approximately 2 meters high. It illuminated the entire forest with a white light. The object itself had a pulsing red light on top and a bank of blue lights underneath. The object was hovering or on legs. As the patrolman approached the object, it maneuvered through the trees and disappeared. At this time, the animals on a nearby farm went into a frenzy. The object was briefly sighted approximately an hour later near the back gate. News of the Woodbridge incident first leaked out in January 1981 when Brenda Butler, co-author of Sky Crash, was approached by a U.S. Air Force security officer who had proven to be a reliable source of information in the past. Given the pseudonym of Steve Roberts by Butler, he confided that a UFO had crash-landed in Rendlesham Forest on the night of the 27th of December, and that he had himself witnessed its three small silver-suited occupants carrying out repairs while suspended in a shaft of light. The craft had remained on the ground for several hours, he claimed, during which time General Gordon Williams, overall base commander at the time, had communicated with the aliens. Many military personnel were present, and films and photos were taken, which were immediately confiscated by senior officers when the craft had taken off. A few weeks later, another investigator, Paul Begg, was told quite independently by a radar operator at RAF Watton in Norfolk that an uncorrelated target was picked up on their radar sets on the night of the 27th of December. A few days later, USAF intelligence officers, probably from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, turned up at Watton and told the radar men that it was possible they had tracked an unknown structured object that had crash-landed in a forest near Ipswich. Military personnel who went to investigate found the engine and lights of their jeep failing as they approached the landing site and had to proceed on foot. They allegedly encountered an unidentified object on the ground, and General Williams was said to have communicated with its occupants. Yet another USAF security officer later came forward with a story of having witnessed the landed UFO. Given the pseudonym Art Wallace, he was subsequently revealed as Sergeant Larry Warren, who was stationed at Bentwaters at the time. Warren claims that the date of the actual landing was the 30th, not the 27th of December. He says that the jeep in which he and other security officers were riding in en route to the landing site kept failing, but that the greatest discrepancies lie in his description of the landed craft and the events that subsequently unfolded. On arrival at a clearing in the forest, he encountered other groups of military personnel, including RAF officers, and he could hear helicopters overhead. A movie camera was pointing towards something which looked like a transparent aspirin tablet, hovering just above the ground, about 50 feet in diameter, surrounded by security officers. A bright red light approached from behind the trees, descended silently over the aspirin, and then exploded in a multiple-colored burst of light. Both the aspirin and light vanished, leaving in their place a large dome disc with intricate patterns on its surface. Warren and a couple of colleagues approached it, but the next thing he recalls is being back in bed at the Bentwaters base. Together with other witnesses, he was ordered to see the base commander, who told them all that they must not discuss what had happened, as it had a high security level. Warren also claims that his clothes were checked for radioactivity. He learned from other witnesses that those who had been on the far side of the object, i.e. opposite his position, had seen small alien beings. He was also told that false trails had been laid in the forest and that stories of alien contact were invented in order to discredit the entire story. In October 1986, I spoke with Colonel Charles Halt, who is currently based with the 485th Tactical Missile Wing. My first question dealt with the authenticity and accuracy of his document to the Ministry of Defense. As far as you're concerned, Colonel Halt, your memorandum is legitimate, I asked. It certainly is, he affirmed. He denied that any movie film was taken of the UFO. I then asked Colonel Halt if the radar tapes at RAF Watton had been confiscated by USAF intelligence officers. Well, I don't know that they were confiscated, he answered. I do know that they were used at a later date because I was questioned specifically on times and areas of the sky and so on. It's your government's business, not mine. And the story of aliens? Had this been thrown in to confuse the issue, I wanted to know? There's only one individual who talks about that, and I can't speak for him, said the colonel. I can't disprove what he says, but I can't corroborate it either. There are a lot of things that are not in my memo, but there was no response from the Ministry of Defense, so I didn't go any further with them. On the 4th of March, 1982, the Earl of Clancarty asked in the House of Lords, how many reports have been received by the Ministry of Defense on unidentified flying objects in each of the last 4 years, and what action had been taken in each case? Viscount Long, representing the government, replied, my lords, in 1978, there were 750 sightings. In 1979, there were 550 sightings. In 1980, 350 sightings. And in 1981, 600 sightings. All UFO reports are passed to operations staff, who examine them solely for possible defense implications. The Earl of Clancarty was not satisfied with these figures, and stated that he believed the number to be far higher, but Viscount Long explained that not all reports reached the MOD. If the noble earl is suspicious that the Ministry of Defense is covering up in any way, I can assure him that there is no reason why we should cover up the figures which he has mentioned if they are true, he said. The Earl of Kimberley, former liberal spokesman on aerospace and a member of the House of Lords UFO Study Group, then asked Viscount Long how many of the 600 sightings reported to the MOD in 1981 still remain unidentified and were not subject to security or were Russian airplanes or anything like that. Long's reply was as amusing as it was unconvincing. My lords, I do not have those figures. They disappeared into the unknown before we got them. On the 7th of April, 1982, another question was raised in the House of Lords. The Earl of Cork and Orrery asked, how many of the 2,250 sightings of UFOs reported to the Ministry of Defense in the years 1978 through 1981 were and still are classified for reasons of security? Viscount Long, again replying for the government, jumped up and stated enthusiastically, none, my lords. The Earl then asked two supplementary questions, one of which inquired into the possibility of the Ministry of Defense releasing reports to interested individuals and organizations. Long said that there was no reason why he should not come and see the reports. Not many of them come in because not many people actually report sightings. There is no cover-up in that respect. Finally, the Earl of Clancarty asked about an alleged MOD document published in 1978 in which, under the heading Contacts, 18 names are listed, and alongside each name is given the hometown of the witness plus dates and times. The document had supposedly been distributed to other government departments as well as to the North American Aerospace Defense Command and the CIA. Replied Viscount Long, yes, my lords, I have the document here, and it has nothing to do with the Ministry of Defense. It is made up to look rather like a Christmas menu. Its existence in the Ministry of Defense has been denied on television. Someone else has made it up. And someone else had made it up, in my opinion. The document is a forgery designed to discredit the subject. Of the 18 names listed in the document, 3 are stated to be from London. Of those 3, 2 are not listed in the current telephone directory, and the 3rd, D.M. Smith, London, Southwest, has no less than 12 entries for Southwest London alone, a convenient choice of name indeed. Similarly, another very common name, S.D.D. Patel of Southall, Middlesex, has at least 12 entries under S.D. Patel alone. In 1984, the Ministry of Defense released 16 of its reports on UFO sightings to the British UFO Research Association, due largely to the initiative of the now-defunct House of Lords UFO Study Group. Although this was an encouraging step forward, the reports, all of sightings in Wales, lack crucial information, and the final sections containing the results of the MOD's investigations have been excised. The MOD had previously refused to release such reports, even in truncated form, stating, publication would involve much editorial work both to preserve the anonymity and privacy of the people who have written to the department and also to delete any references to classified subjects. The Ministry of Defense has not the resources to undertake this editing at present, and there is no guarantee that it will be undertaken in the future. However, an MOD spokesman told Martin Bailey of The Observer that they were now willing to consider providing reports on specific incidents to serious inquirers. A few more innocuous reports have since been released, such as those obtained by one of Britain's leading groups, the Yorkshire UFO Society. There is little evidence that these, as well as the Welsh reports, were investigated thoroughly, beyond ensuring that no defense implications were involved. This, after all, is where the Ministry's primary responsibility lies, as they have repeatedly reminded me. Rumors of secret Ministry of Defense research into UFOs have occasionally surfaced over the years, but nothing of substance has emerged since 1957, when it was reliably reported that top-secret studies were being conducted by the Air Ministry in Northumberland Avenue, London, where the Defense Intelligence staff still carry out intelligence evaluation. This was corroborated by Gordon Creighton, a former intelligence officer who served with the Joint Intelligence Bureau, among others, who told me that RAF intelligence officers regularly liaised with their American counterparts as well as the CIA on the UFO problem. Shortly afterward, I learned from two completely independent sources that top-secret research into UFOs was carried out by the RAF at a certain establishment in Wilshire. The name of that establishment is RAF Rudlow Manor. Situated exactly 100 miles from London in Pastoral Wiltshire, Rudlow Manor is officially listed as a headquarters of the RAF Support Command. The UFO Research Center comprises no more than 30 personnel, I am told, and is manned permanently. One of my informants told me that Rudlow Manor also serves or did serve as a tracking station for UFOs. In about 1971, for instance, a radar expert employed there tracked an unknown aerial object for 2 days, and there was general agreement that nothing on Earth could account for the fantastic maneuverability of the object. That Rudlow Manor is involved in UFO research to some extent seems borne out by the fact that it functions as a 24-hour receiving station for reports from members of the public, although this is denied by the MOD. That the Flying Complaints flight is the receiving point is partly proven to my satisfaction by the fact that Ralph Noyes was advised by the duty officer at Rudlow Manor to address a letter giving further details of his sightings to the Flying Complaints flight. What I am unable to prove is that RAF Rudlow Manor functions as a 24-hour top-secret UFO monitoring and research station. Dr. Robert Cregan, professor of philosophy at the State University of New York, has made a number of research trips to Britain and has discussed the question of an official cover-up with various involved parties on an informal basis. I did get the impression, he told me, that pressure applied by officials in the United States was a cause, or one of the causes, for a British policy of giving so little information vis-à-vis the UFO problem. Dr. Cregan has also stated, "It was made evident to me that the British at the time, 1970s, desired to please the U.S. establishment, and it was strongly hinted that U.S. officials seemed rather excitable about UFO problems and were making frantic efforts to suppress public interest. It was indicated that a panicky U.S. attitude was the reason for British silence. The ministry had to appease the American military-industrial complex, and so could not assist one in a search for the truth." He concluded, "UFOs alarm the establishment because, whatever theory is correct, a major loss of control is apprehended, associated with reports of objects which affect mechanisms of control and which deeply puzzle and confuse both the public and many of its would-be leaders. From London to Palo Alto, I have registered many signs appearing to indicate that the present is indeed the dawn of an age of panic. Free and universal access to even more puzzling truths is the one thing needed if people are ever again to live undismayed." France, with its independent defense policy, has pursued an equally independent policy on UFOs since the early 1950s. In July 1952, a government research committee was set up, replaced by a general staff committee in 1954. French Secretary of State for Air, M.M. Quatreau, was asked by French MP M. Jean Nocher to set up a commission to study this phenomenon objectively by extracting the truth from among the mistakes and possible hoaxes. Robert Gallet stated in the 1974 broadcast that a department had been established in the Ministry of Defense for the purpose of collecting and studying the many reports that were flooding in during the great global wave of sightings in 1954. That department was based at the headquarters of the French Air Force's Department of Research. Gallet confirmed that there were sighting reports from pilots from the commanding personnel of various Air Force centers with quite a lot of details, all of which agree in quite a disturbing manner, all in the course of the year 1954. A curious sequel to the French minister's interview was that tapes of interviews with eminent ufologists, which were to have been broadcast as part of the series, were stolen from Jean-Claude Bourret's office. Had the minister's positive statements gone too far? During the 1954 UFO wave, there were many reports of landed craft complete with occupants, and one of the most impressive cases is that of Marius de Wilde. On the 10th of September at about 10:30 p.m., de Wilde was alerted by the sound of his dog howling and trying to get inside his house near Quarolles. He took his flashlight and saw outside. two creatures, such as I had never seen before, were not more than 3 or 4 yards from me. The one in front turned toward me. The beam of my light caught a reflection from glass or metal where his face should have been. I had the distinct impression that his head was enclosed in a diver's helmet. In fact, both creatures were dressed in one-piece outfits like the suits divers wear. They were very short, probably less than 3.5 feet tall, but very wide in the shoulders, and the helmets protecting their heads looked enormous. I could see their legs, small in proportion to their height, it seemed to me, but on the other hand, I couldn't see any arms. I don't know whether they had any. The investigation which followed involved the Airborne Gendarmerie, the Mobile Gendarmerie, and the DST, France's equivalent of the British MI5 or the American FBI. In 1977, the Groupe d'études phénoménaux aérospatiaux non identifiés, or GEPAN, was established under the auspices of the Centre National d'études spatiales, CNES, France's equivalent of the American Space Agency, NASA. GEPAN had a committee of 7 scientists, headed by Dr. Claude Pohay, director of the Sounding Rockets Division of CNES. The group was to collaborate with the Gendarmerie and was given access to laboratories and scientific centers all over France, as well as other agencies around the world. President Giscard d'Estaing took a close personal interest in the project. It all looked very promising at first. For example, in an analysis of 11 cases studied in 1978, GEPAN concluded that in as many as 9 cases a physical phenomenon existed whose origin, propulsion, and modus operandi were beyond human knowledge. Well, later that year, Dr. Jean Gilles, chargé de recherche at the Center for Scientific Research, CNRS, attended a GEPAN meeting for private investigation groups at the CNES headquarters in Toulouse. He was told during the 7-hour meeting that the scientific attachés at GEPAN could only devote 10% of their time to those cases that were given to them by the Gendarmerie. More significantly, Dr. Gilles discovered that those cases that GEPAN did receive had been screened by the highest authority in the Gendarmerie Nationale. Astrophysicist Dr. Pierre Guérin of the French Institute of Astrophysics explained to me that the majority of scientists reject UFOs because they simply do not fit into a current scientific framework. In science, there is no proof of any phenomenon if no scientific model for it exists. The observation of the facts is not the actual fact. We have the testimonial proof, but not the scientific proof. Scientists are not only embarrassed by UFOs, they're furious because they don't understand them. There is no possibility of explaining them in 3-dimensional space-time physics. Despite rumors of GEPAN's demise, the organization continues, albeit on a limited scale. In 1983, the Minister of Defense, Monsieur Charles Arnoux, decided that GEPAN's research should continue under the direction of 2 engineers of the National Center for Space Studies. Some of the results have been highly significant, as Dr. Guérin concedes. In 1983, Dr. Jean-Pierre Petit of the National Center for Scientific Research was told by the head of GEPAN, Jean-Jacques Velasco, "We are collecting UFO reports, but we don't know what to do with them. Once a case has been investigated, we publish a note on it, and that is that. We have no scientific structure behind GEPAN." Dr. Petit goes on to say that during a meeting in Paris, organized by France Inter on the 12th of June 1984, with GEPAN representatives as well as 55 journalists present, the CNES public relations officer, Monsieur Metzl, made a curious admission. In 1977, he's reported to have said, "It was necessary to tranquilize public opinion concerning the UFO phenomenon, and it was in that spirit that GEPAN was created." More recently, Jean-Jacques Velasco announced that GEPAN has collaborated closely with the Gendarmerie to log about 1,600 UFO reports up to 1985. While the majority have been explained as natural phenomena or aircraft, Velasco emphasized that as many as 38% do not fall into this category, a high percentage of unknowns by any standards. Critics who wonder why UFOs never appear over large cities in full view of thousands of witnesses would do well to consider the events that took place over Rome in November 1954, following a wave of sightings in Italy. The Italian diplomat, Dr. Alberto Perego, was among a crowd of about 100 people near the Church of Santa Maria Maggiore on the 30th of October, who stood and gazed upward in astonishment as two white dots moved around the sky in complete silence at a height of about 2,000 meters. Was this some new kind of aircraft? Dr. Perego wondered. On the 6th of November, Dr. Perego was in the Tuscolano district when the white dots appeared, but this time there were dozens of them. Today, between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., he noted at the time, the sky of Rome has been crossed by several dozens of flying machines traveling at a height of around 7,000 or 8,000 meters. They were moving at variable speeds, which at times seemed to be as high as 1,200 or 1,400 kilometers per hour. The machines appeared like white dots, sometimes with a short white trail. At first, I calculated there were about 50 of them, but later I realized that there were at least 100. Sometimes they were isolated, sometimes in pairs or in threes or fours or sevens or twelves. Frequently, they were in diamond or lozenge formations of four or in V formations of seven. At noon, Dr. Perego reported, a large formation of 20 objects appeared from the east, followed by another 20 coming from the opposite direction. The two V-shaped squadrons converged rapidly until the vertices of the two Vs met, thus forming a perfect St. Andrew's cross of 40 machines with 10 to each bar. The convergence seemed to occur at a height of about 7,000 or 8,000 meters over the Trastevere Monte Maria district of Rome, right over the Vatican City. The entire cross then performed a three-quarter turn on its axis, becoming more of an X shape, then broke off into two separate curves which moved off in opposite directions. The performance had lasted about 3 minutes, Dr. Perego noted, but the show was not over. As I watched, I saw what appeared like a large bluish shadow forming in the sky 10 minutes later and realized that it was a fresh concentration building up as, in formations in squadrons of 4 and 7 and 12, they began to reappear. This time I was able to make a better count and could see that they totaled at least 100. This time, the concentration was in another part of the sky and not directly above the Vatican. Dr. Perego then noticed what appeared to be a shining filament-type material coming out of the sky. The substance, that subsequently has been nicknamed angel hair and reported by witnesses throughout the world. I was able to seize a handful of it, he said. It looked like the fine twigs and filaments of a Christmas tree, but thinner and very long. It was not like the filaments used in the last war by the U.S. bombers to disturb the enemy radar, chaff. It was not tin foil, but rather a glassy sort of substance, which evaporated completely in a few hours. The following day, the 7th of November, not a word appeared in the newspapers. Dr. Perego's inquiries at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs drew a blank. They knew nothing about the sightings. At 11:30 a.m., returning to the Tuscolano district, Perego was astonished to see further formations of objects, totaling about 50, which remained in the sky for 2.5 hours. The squadrons would always arrive from different directions, he recalled, and always in regular formations. They would fly away over the country around Rome and return in formation 10 minutes later for the next concentration. Yet again, the strange angel hair descended over Rome, which thousands of people must have witnessed. But there was still no word from the press, apart from a report in Il Messaggero, that in England, RAF radar had detected squadrons of mysterious objects on the 6th of November. At the British War Office, they are concerned, concluded the report, but not, it seems, in the Italian War Office. The next day, Dr. Perego called an Air Force General Pezzi, chief of the cabinet of the Ministry of Defense. He received me very courteously, said Perego, but he said he knew nothing whatever about the events I described. I read my notes to him and asked him to report the matter to the Minister of Defense. On the 10th of November, Dr. Perego was received by the Principal Secretary of Foreign Affairs, but drew a blank once more. He knew nothing about the matter and was surprised that the military authorities had made no report to him. The reason became apparent the following day, when Perego visited General Di Vincente, commander of the Italian Air Force, who explained that since radar operated over certain fixed zones at certain times, and only up to 6,000 to 7,000 meters, nothing had been tracked. When the mysterious objects made yet another appearance over Rome on the 12th of November, again in the morning, Dr. Perego immediately contacted General De Vincente at Air Defense Headquarters, who said that orders had been issued for observations to be made. Perego paid a visit to the Vatican Observatory at Castel Gandolfo near Rome and learned that a Brazilian priest on duty at about 11 a.m. had seen some strange objects pass twice over the observatory, very low and at a terrific speed, in complete silence. It was 2 years before Dr. Perego came to accept the fact that what he and thousands of others witnessed over Rome could only have been the manifestation of an extraterrestrial intelligence, a revelation that inspired him to become a leading champion of disci volante, flying saucers. In Australia, responsibility for monitoring unidentified or unusual aerial sightings, UAS, as they are officially designated, rests solely with the Royal Australian Air Force. At each RAAF base, specific officers are appointed to investigate sightings, investigation being restricted to those instances formally reported to the RAAF. When required, assistance is sought from other government departments, such as aviation, meteorology, science and technology for satellite predictions, plus observatories. No Australian Secret Service participates in the investigations. The percentage breakdown of RAAF investigations closely matches those of the Royal Air Force and U.S. Air Force investigations, and only about 3% of the reports are attributable to unknown causes. In all its investigations to date, which average about 100 per year, the RAAF have found no tangible evidence of life from other planets. On the 23rd of August, 1953, the Deputy Director of Civil Aviation in New Guinea, Tom Drury, took an 8mm movie film using a telephoto lens of a UFO over Port Moresby. The object was elongated like a bullet and shot out of a cloud, traveling at a speed estimated to be at least 5 times faster than a jet flying at the speed of sound. It never slackened speed or changed direction, said Drury, but simply faded into the blue sky while its vapor trail faded after it. The vapor trail was very clear-cut. This is visible in the remaining section of the film in my possession. What became of the rest? He had sent the original film, consisting of 94 frames, to the Minister for Air, William McMahon, who in turn sent it to the U.S. Air Force at the Pentagon. The film was returned about 9 months later, minus the most important frame showing the actual object. Bill Chalker eventually discovered 5 negatives of photographs of some individual frames from the film in a 1973 Directorate of Air Force Intelligence file, but the actual film showing the UFO has never been returned to its owner. Chalker has confirmed that it was examined by the Naval Photographic Interpretation Center, Maryland, then apparently under the aegis of the CIA. A former employee of the National Security Agency, Todd Zetchel, charges that the film was retained by the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence. In the spring of 1954, some 200 photographs, as well as movie film, were taken of an unidentified flying object that paced 3 young men who were driving through the Australian interior near the border between Western Australia and Southern Australia. Shortly afterward, while they were still driving, an RAAF light aircraft suddenly appeared and landed not far from them. The men were ordered to halt, and a member of the crew asked them to hand over their films, saying they wanted to borrow them. The photographs and film have never been seen since. The Australian Security and Intelligence Organization, ASIO, developed from the Allied Intelligence Bureau with the cooperation of the British in 1948, is divided into 2 main branches, one for intelligence gathering and the other responsible for counter-espionage. The RAAF stated that there had been no participation by either the ASIO or ASIS, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, in UFO investigations. Yet there is some evidence for involvement of the former. In 1959, Stan Sears, president of the Queensland Flying Saucer Research Bureau at the time, now UFO Research Queensland, received a phone call from a man requesting a meeting in a large car park in Brisbane, hinting that Sears might learn something to his advantage about UFOs. At no time did the caller identify himself or his business until Sears met him at the appointed meeting place, where he produced an identity card and introduced himself as D.D. of the Australian Security and Intelligence Organization. During the weeks that followed, Mr. D. personally interviewed all 12 members of the QFSRB committee. Mr. D. carefully cultivated the friendship of at least two committee members, and to all intents and purposes became an ardent UFO enthusiast himself. But Sears' misgivings about this ploy were realized when about a year later the close friendship that had always existed between the committee members began to deteriorate. Sears claims to have evidence from members of at least one other state UFO group that similar surveillance and attempts at destabilization by the ASIO have been carried out, although in a more covert manner. ASIO is not the only Australian intelligence agency said to have been involved in studying the UFO problem. Bill Chalker, a thorough and reliable investigator, confirms that a scientist attached to the Directorate of Scientific and Technical Intelligence, which was part of the Joint Intelligence Bureau, now the Joint Intelligence Organization, cooperated with other defense intelligence scientists in 1968-69 in organizing a proposal for a rapid intervention team to investigate those UFO incidents involving physical evidence. However, as a result of criticizing the Air Force's handling of UFO reports, he was denied access to them, and plans for the rapid intervention team were shelved. The former JIB scientist affirms that although the Directorate of Air Force Intelligence files on UFOs are the most substantial, there are other files held by the Department of Defense that are unlikely to see the light of day. This owes more, however, to the sensitive methods by which the reports were received than the actual content. In 1963, Senator J. L. Kavanaugh asked that the federal government dossier on UFOs should be made public, but the Minister for Air refused, stating that no single dossier containing all the facts was available, and although 3-4% of sightings remained unexplained, the vast majority of reports could be explained in terms of balloons, aircraft, and astronomical objects. But others were convinced that a cover-up was in operation, including Dr. Harry Mezel, professor of physics at Sydney University, who stated in 1965, "The facts about saucers were long tracked down, and results have long been known in top-secret defense circles of more countries than one." Whatever the truth, it might be regarded as inadvisable to give people at large no clue about the true nature of these things. An example of a report that probably never found its way into the RAAF files, but certainly ended up with the CIA, if not the ASIO, has been provided by Bud Hopkins. A U.S. Air Force sergeant with a top-secret clearance known to Hopkins states that in 1967 he was shown a movie film of a UFO at a CIA screening in Texas, which had been taken from a converted RAAF aircraft during a photo-mapping flight over Central Australia in about 1965. The short film extract showed a huge hovering windowed craft with three smaller UFOs attached to it as a kind of tail. A door on the largest object opened, two vertical panels and two horizontally aligned ones sliding apart, and the three smaller UFOs flew inside. The panels closed. The large object canted at an angle, then disappeared in seconds. According to Bud Hopkins' informant, the filmed image of the UFOs was extraordinarily large and clear, filling the entire movie screen. If the authorities have nothing to hide, why are we denied access to films such as these? In 1968, members of the Queensland Flying Saucer Research Bureau set up two magnetic monitoring devices attached to self-activating movie cameras at sites where UFO activity had previously been reported. One site was at Horseshoe Lagoon, Tully, Queensland, where in January 1966, George Pedley claimed to have seen a saucer-shaped object take off, causing his tractor engine to stall and leaving a circular swirled imprint in the reeds where it had taken off from. Further sightings and saucer nests had subsequently been reported in the vicinity. On the 2nd of March, a North Queensland radio station broadcast a news flash which announced that an airliner flying from Cairns to Iron Range had been paced at 6,000 feet for a short while by an unidentified flying object some 2,000 feet above them, which then shot off at an estimated 1,500 miles per hour. Inspection of the monitoring device at Horseshoe Lagoon revealed that it had been triggered and that the 8mm movie camera was found to be still running slowly, one side of its 50 feet of film having been expended. The batteries were renewed, the film spool turned over, and the camera was then set up to cover a wider area of the lagoon. On the 4th of March, a number of local witnesses reported a UFO sighting, and the camera was again found to have been activated. For some reason, unfortunately, only 15 or 16 frames had been exposed, and the batteries were completely dead, Stan Sears reported. The remainder of the film was wound through by hand, removed from the camera, sealed in the usual container, and addressed to Kodak of Melbourne, all in the presence of two reliable witnesses, he reported. It was next handed in at the Tully post office counter, weighed, a 14-cent stamp affixed, and then placed directly into the mailbag by the post office official. I personally checked on this aspect of the affair, and there is no doubt whatever that Vincent Mail, the owner of the film, did not handle it again after handing it across the counter for weighing. 14 days later, Mail received a package from Kodak. Inside was an empty container complete with wrapping and the 14-cent stamp, plus a covering letter asking if Mail had forgotten to enclose the film. Had it really been intercepted or merely misplaced? Stan Sears learned later that the posting of the film had been discussed by several members of the QFSRB in the presence of Mr. D of the Australian Security and Intelligence Organization. Suspecting that the ASIO may have planted an agent in the Kodak processing department, which was later confirmed by two independent sources, Sears telephoned Mr. D and made a direct accusation, demanding the immediate return of the film to its owner. In the event of its non-return, I made it quite clear that I would lodge a complaint through Parliament. He was too shrewd to make an immediate denial, merely saying that he would inquire and phone me back. 1 hour later, he did so and said, "You've got the wrong department, Stan." But from his manner, I felt reasonably sure that he knew where it was. By this time, I was thoroughly furious and phoned Colin Bennett, a well-known barrister and member of Parliament, and lodged a complaint but refrained from mentioning ASIO, as at that stage I had no acceptable proof. I have always considered the probability that the film contained nothing but a view of the lagoon, but the fact remained that it had been probably stolen by a government department. After Colin Bennett had examined the available evidence, he agreed to take up the case on behalf of the QFSRB, but the outcome was not encouraging. Gordon Freeth, Minister for Air, denied all knowledge of the missing film in a letter to Bennett in August 1968. I can assure you that my department has not in any way attempted to interfere with the processing or return of these films. In fact, my department has no knowledge of any such films having been sent to Kodak for processing. Vincent Mail lodged a complaint with his local police. But some weeks later, he was taken aside by a plainclothes detective, a personal friend, who advised him to drop the matter. "You haven't got a hope of getting it back," he said. On about the 13th of March, 1968, shortly after the loss of the film, two RAAF helicopters were seen for some while over the Horseshoe Lagoon, witnessed by the owner of the land. Whether this was just coincidental, of course, is not known, but in view of the fact that circular nests had been formed in the vicinity where UFOs had been seen to take off from, there is a probability that the RAAF needed aerial photographs of the sites. Stan Deo, a former U.S. Air Force pilot, claims that in 1972, during a meeting with Dr. Tom Keeble, director of the Mechanical Engineering Division of the Department of Defense Aeronautical Research Laboratory in Melbourne, Keeble disclosed that the RAAF have extensive movie film libraries of UFOs. Deo claims that these films and other classified material on UFOs are kept at RAAF East Sale, Victoria. I wrote to Dr. Keeble checking on the veracity of this story, but received no reply. Certainly, if such films exist in RAAF archives, and I am confident they do, East Sale would be the logical repository, since it is a center for military photographic interpretation. On the 2nd of May 1984, the RAAF curtailed its lengthy public association with the UFO controversy when the Minister of Defense, Gordon Scholes, stated, "The vast majority of reports submitted by the public have proved not to have a national security significance." This is probably correct, but what about the small residue of unexplained sightings by the public, to say nothing of military reports? It is self-evident that these are of enormous significance and clearly affect national security. Yet the public must not be told the truth. One of the most important documents on UFOs to be released in Canada is a hitherto top-secret memorandum from Wilbert B. Smith, senior radio engineer with the Canadian Government Department of Transport, at the time and a highly respected scientist who held a master's degree in electrical engineering and several patents. The memo, dated 21st of November 1950, was sent to the Controller of Telecommunications and recommended that a research project be set up to study the subject. "We believe that we are on the track of something which may well prove to be the introduction to a new technology," Smith wrote. "The existence of a different technology is borne out by the investigations which are being carried out at the present time in relation to flying saucers." Smith went on to state that through discreet inquiries made at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, he had learned from Dr. Robert Sarbacker that "the matter is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb. Flying saucers exist. Their modus operandi is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, and the entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance." Here we have incontrovertible evidence for the high security classification attached to the subject. The reference to the small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush is equally significant, since in 1947, following the retrieval of parts of a UFO near Roswell, New Mexico, a small select group codenamed Majestic 12 was established to inform the president about UFO developments, and it was headed by Dr. Bush. The Department of Transport was not slow in accepting Smith's recommendation, and on the 2nd of December 1950, Project Magnet was established by Commander C.P. Edwards, then Deputy Minister of Transport for Air Services. Smith was appointed engineer in charge, with another two engineers and two technicians working part-time. The broadcast and measurement section of the telecommunications division was given a directive to carry out the project with whatever assistance could be obtained from sources such as the Defense Research Board and National Research Council. Dr. O. M. Salant, chairman of the Defense Research Board, offered his full cooperation. The Canadian government has continually tried to play down the work of Wilbert Smith and Project Magnet. In 1964, for example, the Department of Transport informed an inquirer, "We would reiterate that at no time has this department carried out research into the field of unidentified flying objects." As stated by Mr. Dupuy in Hansard on December 4, 1963, a small program of investigations in the field of geomagnetics was carried out by the telecommunications division of this department between 1950 and 1954. This minor investigation was for the purpose of studying magnetic phenomena, particularly those phenomena resulting from unusual boundary conditions in the basic electromagnetic theory. This personal project was at no expense to the department, nor did it have any departmental sponsorship. That the government was lying has now been established with the release of official Project Magnet documents. During a recorded interview with C.W. Fitch and George Popovich in November 1961, Wilbert Smith admitted that a number of fragments from UFOs had been recovered and analyzed by his research group, including one that had been shot from a UFO near Washington, D.C. in July 1952. Said Smith, "I was informed that the disc was glowing and was about 2 feet in diameter. A glowing chunk flew off and the pilot saw it glowing all the way to the ground. He radioed his report and a ground party hurried to the scene. The thing was still glowing when they found it an hour later. The entire piece weighed about a pound. The segment that was loaned to me was about one-third of that. It had been sawed off. There was iron rust. The thing was in reality a matrix of magnesium orthosilicate. The matrix had great numbers, thousands of 15-micron spheres scattered through it." Smith was asked if he had returned the piece to the U.S. Air Force when he had completed his analysis. "Not the Air Force, much higher than that," he replied. "The Central Intelligence Agency?" asked the interviewers. "I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I don't care to go beyond that point," said Smith, but added, "I can say to you that it went to the hands of a highly classified group. You will have to solve that problem, their identity, for yourselves." In my opinion, that group was Majestic 12. In 1964, an enormous circular object, spewing flame-colored exhaust, passed slowly over a car occupied by Bert Gammy and his mother and daughter. After he telephoned the RCAF in Vancouver, Gammy was visited by a senior officer who carried a briefcase full of UFO photographs to make comparisons. The officer, whom Gammy knew, emphasized that despite their acquaintanceship, He would deny having been there if the visit received any publicity. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police also takes UFO sightings very seriously and has received hundreds of reports over the years. Former RCMP officer John Pushy confirms that he has spoken to people who have served in military radar stations, as well as other people who had apparently seen something but had been afraid to say anything about it. I realize that many government agencies take UFO sightings seriously, the RCMP being one, he admitted in 1980. Policy in the past has been to report all investigations concerning sightings on secret letterhead. I can personally vouch for this, as I served with the RCMP for 5 years. By far, the most evidential case ever to have been reported in Canada is that of Stephen Michalak, who encountered a landed UFO near Falcon Lake on the boundary between Manitoba and Ontario on the 20th of May, 1967. At 12:15 p.m. that day, Michalak, who was engaged in some amateur prospecting, was startled to see two cigar-shaped objects with bumps on them, glowing red and descending. The objects appeared more oval and disc-shaped as they came closer. Suddenly, the object furthest away stopped in midair as the other came nearer and then landed about 160 feet away. The object in the air hovered for a short period, then departed silently, changing color from red to orange to gray, then back to orange as it disappeared behind clouds. The craft on the ground also changed color from red to gray and finally hot stainless steel, surrounded by a goldenish glow. It was about 35 feet in diameter and 12 feet high. A door then opened in the side of the craft with lights coming from the inside. Michalak decided to approach closer, and when he was 60 feet away, heard two human-like voices, one higher pitched than the other. Convinced by now that the device was a new experimental American aircraft, he asked the occupants if they were having trouble. There was no response. Suddenly, three panels closed completely over the opening, so Michalak began to examine the side of the craft with his gloved hand. When he pulled his hand back, he found that the glove had burned and melted, as had his hat. The craft, or at least the rim, then seemed to change position, for he found himself facing a grid-type exhaust vent, which he had noticed earlier to the left of the opening. A blast of hot air then struck his chest, setting his shirt and vest alight, causing severe pain. He ripped these off and looked up to see the craft taking off like the first object and felt a rush of air. A strong smell similar to burned electrical circuits combined with sulfur pervaded the air. In August 1968, Michalak spent 2 weeks at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, USA, at his own expense. He was found to be in good health, apart from neurological dermatitis and simple syncope, fainting spells due to sudden cerebral blood pressure loss, attributed to hyperventilation or impaired cardiac input. Michalak had been suffering from heart problems for a number of years. Psychiatric tests showed no evidence of delusions, hallucinations, or other emotional disorders. A peculiar geometric pattern of burn marks which appeared on Michalak's chest and abdomen was diagnosed as being thermal in origin. The marks matched the exhaust grill of the UFO, which had about 30 small openings. Altogether, Michalak was examined by a total of 27 doctors, and none was able to explain fully the cause of his symptoms. Squadron Leader P. Biskey, representing the Royal Canadian Air Force, concluded that the entire case was a hoax, yet a statement in the National Research Council's Non-Meteoritic UFO Sightings File, Department of National Defense, reads, "Neither the DND nor the RCMP investigation teams were able to provide evidence which could dispute Mr. Michalak's story, and the RCMP forensic analysis was unable to reach any conclusion as to what may have caused the burn damage to Michalak's clothing." Wilbert Smith, whose untimely death of cancer in 1962 robbed not only Canada but the world of one of the most intelligent and original minds in the field of UFO research, was well qualified to assess the various reasons behind the official cover-up, having headed Canada's first secret investigation into the subject. Smith affirmed that the United States authorities were well aware that UFOs were of alien origin, and that it was soon apparent that these objects did not constitute any particular menace to humanity and there was practically nothing which we could do about it if they did. The aliens were in complete control of the situation, while we were mere observers. Since the various classified U.S. Air Force projects were largely aimed at debunking UFO reports, Smith said, the Air Force had painted themselves into an awkward corner. What solid information did come out of these projects was most disturbing indeed, striking at the very roots of our conventional science. But there wasn't enough of this information on which to base any substantial reform in scientific thinking, just enough to produce an uneasy feeling that all was not well. So naturally, the least said about this, the better, until more was known. Meanwhile, since they do not have enough answers for the questions that are now being raised, they most certainly are not going to invite a deluge of further questions by admitting anything. Since the modern era of UFO sightings began in World War II, practically no information has been available from the country with the largest population in the world, the People's Republic of China. But in 1978, China's leading newspaper, the People's Daily, published the first article to appear on the subject, written by Shang Hengyan of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Further articles were published in the Guangming Daily during the following 2 years. In 1980, a Chinese UFO researcher, Paul Dong, Moon Wai, a resident of California, wrote an article featuring reports by pilots, scientists, and other reliable observers throughout the world. Tremendous interest in a hitherto forbidden subject was now aroused throughout China. Aerospace Knowledge Journal, for example, received several hundred letters requesting the Chinese government to launch an investigation into the phenomenon. And in May 1980, the Chinese UFO Studies Association was established under the auspices of Wuhan University in central China. The association was headed by a 25-year-old astrophysics student, Chao Lei Ping. Subsequently, the association became incorporated into the China UFO Research Organization as an official branch of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Some measure of the degree of enthusiasm for UFOs in China is reflected in the fact that the China UFO Research Organization's first issue of the Journal of UFO Research sold 300,000 copies on the newsstands. Paul Dong, editor-in-chief of the journal, lectured on the subject all over China in 1981. Since that time, hundreds more cases, some dating back to 1940 and even earlier, have been gathered and published in the journal. Why did the Chinese wait so long to take the UFO problem seriously? According to Paul Dong, three specific factors prompted the Chinese government to recognize the phenomenon. On a summer evening in 1965, two bright, disc-shaped objects violated Peking's airspace. 2 years later, a similar incident occurred near the outskirts of Peking when a bright, globe-shaped object was observed by thousands of witnesses as it streaked across the night sky at fantastic speeds, stopped and hovered, then disappeared over the horizon. Speculation among the masses that Taiwan or another hostile country had developed a secret weapon that might threaten China's national security led to the sanctioning of the academic research group. The third factor leading to official recognition was the frequency of reports received by the authorities from the provinces in the late 1970s. On an unspecified date at 2200 hours in the early part of 1970, a peasant of the Triang district of Fujian province saw a metallic pan-shaped flying object descend and land behind a hill. The object radiated a brilliant green light and a strange musical tone could be heard emanating from it. The peasant duly reported this to the village headman, and the local army commander mobilized hundreds of soldiers who attempted to surround the object. After about an hour, the UFO emitted a bright white light, forcing the soldiers to retreat as it rapidly took off vertically. A member of the militia present, who insisted on anonymity, said that although they could see the brilliant light, they were unable to hear any sound while they observed the object. The most spectacular multiple witness sighting ever to have been reported in China took place at 8:30 p.m. on the 7th of July, 1977, in Shangpo County in Fujian Province. Nearly 3,000 people were watching an open-air showing of the Romanian film Alert on the Danube Delta when a section of the audience suddenly saw two oblate orange-colored luminous objects descending toward the crowd. The objects pass so low over the spectators that they almost touch the ground, emitting a vivid glow and flying only a few meters apart. Heat could be felt, and a low humming sound was heard. Panic spread, and people threw themselves to the ground. In the ensuing stampede, 2 children were trampled to death, and 200 more were injured. The UFOs ascended rapidly and disappeared in seconds. Lingbing Jiang, a doctor at the county hospital, and Chen Kaif, an officer of the County Public Security Bureau, and another official have corroborated this sensational incident. The authorities, suspecting an optical illusion related to the film, reran it, but nothing unusual showed up. On the 26th of July, 1977, there were many sightings of UFOs reported from Chengdu City, Sichuan Province, and the most detailed account was made by the astronomer Zhang Xiaoshang of the Yunnan Observatory. At 9 to 14 minutes past the 22nd hour Beijing time, on the 26th of July, 1977, I observed a very astonishing and unexplainable aerial phenomenon in the northern suburb of the Chengdu municipality. My eyes were suddenly drawn to a strange spiral object in the air. Because of the peculiarity of its appearance, I at once called some other persons to observe it. At the same time, those people who were cooling themselves in places tens of meters away from me had also noticed this strange phenomenon. In appearance, the core of the object was a yellowish bright star. Its luminosity was second magnitude, with the core as a starting point. A big Archimedes spiral line of light was developed, whose brightness was very evident even under moonlight, and whose color was blue and somewhat green. As a spiral line was drawn out from the core could not have been a star, but a comparatively small object. The line wound about the center 3 or 4 rounds. The whole spiral was actually an ellipse, from my point of view, of not very great ellipticity. The diameter of the major axis was about 5 degrees. Its elevation angle with the horizon was about 60 degrees. This strange object was not only big, but it moved in the air in a straight line. It moved with constant speed, about 10 degrees per minute. Simultaneously with the motion of the core, the spiral line also moved horizontally. No change occurred to the luminosity, size, shape, or the various angular measurements. That is to say, the spiral line did not make any rotating displacement and did not leave any traces in the sky. Until 14 minutes past the hour, when the spiral object was covered up by clouds 10 degrees above the horizon, my observation lasted 5 minutes altogether. From the material supplied by Beijing Planetarium and other agencies, I learned that there were many reports about this phenomenon from various places. The localities were distributed over a north-to-south belt at least 180 kilometers wide. Our records showed that an earlier position observed was to the east of the pole star, 40 degrees above the horizon, and with a space displacement of 90 degrees. The duration of the observation was 10 minutes. What was especially important was that at a distance of 180 kilometers apart, the records about the direction of movement of the strange aerial body in space, made independently by at least 2 different observers, were basically the same. To the present time, this strange phenomenon has not been satisfactorily explained, yet there were thousands of good observers who had seen it. We can only let time decide what it really was. 1980 produced a bumper harvest of UFO sightings in China, when altogether 98 reports were reported to the China UFO Research Organization, although it is believed that many more were unreported. The editor of Aerospace Knowledge, Xie Chu, was prompted to write, "We can no longer ignore the existence of UFOs because of the great number of sightings reported in our country." I have tried for several years to ascertain the official Chinese government attitude to the UFO question, and finally succeeded in 1986 when Mr. Zhang Laigui, air attaché at the Chinese embassy in London, sent me an interesting article on the subject that had appeared in the China Daily in 1985, together with a translation. The air attaché stated in his accompanying letter that he regarded the article as an official statement and viewpoint of the Chinese government. The article is headed UFO Conference Held in Dalian, and reports that several dozen Chinese scientists had gathered in that city in August 1985 to exchange views on UFO research for the first time. Some 40 papers were presented, and 17 of these were selected to be published in collected works. The subjects included viewpoints and methods of the Chinese regarding UFO research, theoretical works on the UFO phenomenon, and the relationship between UFOs and the human body sciences. The article states that there is an enormous degree of interest in the UFO subject in China, and refers to the establishment of the China UFO Research Organization, identified as the China Society of UFO Research, or CSUR, with a total membership of 20,000. Chairman of the CSUR, Professor Liang Renglin of Guangzhou Jinan University, said that more than 600 UFO reports had been made during the past 5 years in China. UFOs are an unresolved mystery with profound influence in the world, the article concludes. Some people believe in their existence, while the opponents think it's a matter of fiction or illusion. Both views are taken into serious consideration in the world. Various kinds of organizations have been established in the world, including USA, USSR, UK, Japan, and Central and South American nations, to try to unveil the UFO mystery. In 1967, the late Dr. Alan Hynek, America's leading UFO researcher, confessed that one of his greatest fears was of waking up one morning and reading in his newspaper that the Russians had solved the UFO mystery. Would they perhaps come up with some hitherto overlooked hypothesis that pointed to a natural explanation, or, more disturbingly, would the Soviets announce the first contact with an extraterrestrial civilization? Either story, said Hynek, would shake America so hard that the launching of Sputnik in 1957 would appear in retrospect as important as a Russian announcement of a particularly large wheat crop. Earlier in 1967, an extraordinary article appeared in the Russian magazine Smena. Dr. Felix Yurevich Ziegel, doctor of science and assistant professor of cosmology at the Moscow Aviation Institute, a respected scientist who had been in charge of cosmonaut training, announced that UFOs were worthy of scientific study. Ziegel also gave an interesting resume of sightings by Soviet scientists since 1960, including that of Assistant Professor V. Zaitsev, who during a flight between Leningrad and Moscow on 12th of July 1964, saw what he described as a huge disk which suddenly appeared below the airliner's fuselage, flew a parallel course for a while, and then turned aside with a burst of speed. The article caused something of a sensation in a country where hitherto only debunking statements and articles, as well as Menzel's book, had appeared on the subject. But in fact, the Soviets had been as deeply concerned as other governments by sightings dating back to 1948 at least. The Soviets, then, have apparently been as mystified as other governments by UFO sightings. According to an unconfirmed report, the CIA learned of this in 1952 from the GRU, Chief Intelligence Directorate of the Soviet General Staff, via double agent Lieutenant Yuri Popov. A secret GRU directive, UZ-1114, ordered an investigation into the UFO problem and stated, Section 3. It is urgently ordered to discover whether the unidentified flying objects are A. secret vehicles of foreign powers which are penetrating Soviet airspace, B. misinformative activity by imperialistic secret services, C. manned or unmanned extraterrestrial probes engaged in the investigation of Earth, or D. an unknown natural phenomenon. Under the Freedom of Information Act, a number of documents released by the CIA clearly indicate concern with the Soviet Union's attitude to the UFO problem. On the 11th of September 1952, the CIA's Assistant Director of Scientific Intelligence, H. Marshall Chadwell, sent a secret memorandum to the CIA Director, General Walter Bedell Smith, in which the former stated, "Intelligence problems include the present level of Russian knowledge regarding these phenomena, possible Soviet intentions and capabilities to utilize these phenomena to the detriment of U.S. security interests, the reasons for silence in the Soviet press regarding flying saucers." The well-known Soviet pilot, chief navigator of Soviet polar aviation, Valentin Arkhuratov, described an encounter with an unidentified aerial object as follows. In 1956, engaged in strategic ice reconnaissance in a Tupolev 4 plane in the area of Greenland, we dropped down from the clouds to fair weather and suddenly noticed an unknown flying craft moving on our port side parallel to our course. It looked very much like a large pearl-colored lens with wavy pulsating edges. At first we thought it was an American aircraft of an unknown design, and since we did not want to encounter it, we went into the clouds again. After we had flown for 40 minutes toward Bear Island, the cloud cover ended abruptly. It cleared ahead, and on our port side we saw once again that same unknown craft. Making up our minds to see it at close quarters, we changed our course abruptly and began the approach movement, informing our base at Amderma of the maneuver. When we changed our course, the unknown flying machine followed suit and moved parallel at our speed. After 15 to 18 minutes of flight, the unknown craft sharply altered its course, sped ahead of us, and rose quickly until it disappeared in the blue sky. We spotted no aerials, superstructure, wings, or portholes on that disk. Nor did we see any exhaust gases or condensation trail. It flew at what seemed to us an impossible speed. Skeptics argue that sightings of this sort, where no solid superstructure is evident, are merely optical phenomena of the mirage, rainbow, or halo type. But Dr. Felix Ziegel, who cited this report, discounts such interpretations in most cases. He also counters the explanation that ball lightning is the cause of many UFO reports. The appearance of UFOs is almost always accompanied by a luminescence of air and the formation of an atmospheric plasma. This fact is the basis for the plasma hypotheses of UFOs as accumulations of atmospheric plasma of the ball lightning type. But this explanation does not hold up either. Ball lightning is always a thunderstorm product, and the appearance of UFOs has no relation to weather. Ball lightning diameters, as a rule, run 4 to 5 inches, no larger. The diameter of flying disks are tens and even hundreds of times that size. The following story was obtained directly from the Soviet embassy in London by the British researcher Derek Mansell in January 1965. The incident is said to have taken place on an unknown date in 1961. According to the report, an Antonov AN-2P mail plane took off from an airfield at or near Sverdlovsk bound for Kurgan, with 7 people on board. About 80 to 100 miles from Sverdlovsk, just after the pilot had communicated with ground control, the aircraft disappeared from the radar screen. Ground control tried unsuccessfully to regain communications, so a search was launched involving several helicopters and a large detachment of troops. Since the captain had radioed a position during his last communication, it did not take long to recover the plane. The aircraft was found in a small clearing in a dense forest, completely intact. There was no way it could have possibly landed there, and the authorities stated that it looked as if the plane had been put down gently from above. But most puzzling of all was the fact that there was no sign of anyone on board. All the mail was intact, and when the engine was tested, it started first time. The Moscow Aviation Institute report claims that an unidentified object was tracked on radar at the control tower and that strange radio signals were heard at the time of the disappearance. No marks or footprints were found at the site, but according to Fenoglio's version of events, a 30-meter-wide clearly defined circle of scorched grass and depressed earth was found at a distance of 100 meters from the aircraft. A degree of collaboration between American and Russian scientists was definitely established in the mid-1960s. It is worth mentioning the comments of Victor Marchetti, former executive assistant to the deputy director of the CIA, in this connection. If it were concluded that UFOs were not of terrestrial origin, but rather vehicles from outer space, the CIA and U.S. government, aware that the phenomenon was of a worldwide nature, would seek cooperation in the investigation from the Earth's other technically advanced nations, such as the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and even the USSR. The CIA would function as the U.S. government's agent, just as the KGB would be the USSR's, MI6 would be the UK's, and so on. These agencies are quite accustomed to cooperating with each other on matters of mutual interest. Cooperation in the intelligence business is not restricted to allies. There are times when the CIA and KGB have found it advantageous to work together. In 1947, flying saucers, a description coined by the press following pilot Kenneth Arnold's famous sightings of 9 disc-shaped objects over the Cascade Mountains in Washington on the 24th of June, began to be seen in ever-increasing numbers all over the United States. Reports were being made by qualified observers such as military and civilian pilots, air traffic controllers, and others whose job depended on their ability to identify objects in the sky. The authorities were alarmed. The FBI denied any involvement in UFO investigations until 1976, when U.S. Navy physicist Dr. Bruce McAbee filed a Freedom of Information Act request and obtained about 1,100 pages of documentation on the subject. Only 3 years earlier, on the 25th of October, 1973, FBI Director Clarence M. Kelly had explained to an inquirer that the investigation of unidentified flying objects is not and never has been a matter that is within the investigative jurisdiction of the FBI. One of the most contentious aspects of the UFO enigma is the allegation that a number of flying saucers have actually crash-landed and been recovered by the military in great secrecy. The claim has been generally dismissed for lack of proof, yet the evidence is compelling. On the evening of the 2nd of July, 1947, a bright, disc-shaped object was seen flying over Roswell, New Mexico, heading northwest. The following day, widely scattered wreckage was discovered about 75 miles northwest of Roswell by a local ranch manager, William Brazel, together with his son and daughter. The authorities were eventually alerted, and a quantity of wreckage was recovered by Major Jesse Marcel, a staff intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group Intelligence Office at the Army Air Forces base at Roswell Field, together with a counterintelligence corps officer. Once the officers had returned to the Roswell base, an official press statement was released, authorized by Colonel William Blanchard, confirming that wreckage of a flying disc had been recovered. Marcel was ordered to load the debris on a B-29 and fly it to Wright Field, now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, at Dayton, Ohio, for examination. On arrival at an intermediate stop at Carswell Army Air Forces Base, Fort Worth, Texas, headquarters of the 8th Air Force, General Roger Ramey took charge and ordered Marcel and others on the plane not to talk to reporters. A second press statement was issued, which stated that the wreckage was nothing more than the remains of a weather balloon and its attached tinfoil radar target, and this was prominently displayed at the press conference. Meanwhile, the real wreckage arrived at Wright Field under armed guard. Marcel returned to Roswell, and Brazel was held incommunicado for nearly a week while the crash site was stripped of every scrap of debris. The unidentified wreckage, scattered over an area three-quarters of a mile long by several hundred feet wide, consisted of various types of material, which, according to Major Marcel, was like nothing he had seen before or since. There was all kinds of stuff. Small beams about three-eighths or a half-inch square with some sort of hieroglyphics on them that nobody could decipher. These looked something like balsa wood, and were of about the same weight, except that they were not wood at all. They were very hard, although flexible, and would not burn. There was a great deal of unusual parchment-like substance, which was brown in color and extremely strong, and a great number of small pieces of metal like tinfoil, except that it wasn't tinfoil. Marcel was quite certain that no bodies were among the debris, and that whatever the object was, it must have exploded above ground level. But the evidence suggests that there was another crash site, in an area west of Socorro, New Mexico, known as the Plains of San Augustine, where witnesses discovered not only a damaged metallic aircraft resting on the flat desert ground, but also dead bodies. According to a document acquired by TV producer Jaime Chandera in 1984, a highly secret panel codenamed Majestic 12, or MJ-12, was formed by President Truman in 1947 to investigate UFOs and report on its findings to the president. The document, dated 18th of November 1952 and classified Top Secret, Magic, Eyes Only, was allegedly prepared for President-elect Dwight Eisenhower and includes the astonishing statement that the remains of four alien bodies were recovered 2 miles from the Roswell wreckage site. The document names the 12 high-ranking members of the panel. They were Lloyd Berkner, Detlev Bronk, Vannevar Bush, James Forrestal, Gordon Gray, Roscoe Hillen-Coulter, Jerome Hunsaker, Donald Menzel, Robert Montague, Sidney Sowers, Nathan Twinig, and Hoyt Vandenberg. On the 23rd of September, 1947, General Twining, then a lieutenant general, commanding general of Air Materiel Command, sent a secret memorandum to Brigadier General George Shulgin, chief of the Air Intelligence Requirements Division at the Pentagon, in response to a request from Air Intelligence concerning the flying discs. Twining stated, "The phenomenon reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious. There are objects probably approximating the shape of a disc of such appreciable size as to appear to be as large as man-made aircraft. The reported operating characteristics, such as extreme rates of climb, maneuverability, particularly in roll, and action which must be considered evasive when sighted or contacted by friendly aircraft and radar, lend belief to the possibility that some of the objects are controlled either manually, automatically, or remotely." Official concern over sightings in the vicinity of some of the United States' most sensitive installations, such as the Los Alamos Atomic Energy Commission project, led to a deluge of unanswerable questions. On the 16th of February, 1949, a secret conference was held at Los Alamos to discuss the UFO phenomena, in particular the so-called green fireballs, which were then being reported in the area. Among the scientists and military officials present were the nuclear physicist Dr. Edward Teller and Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, an astronomer from the University of New Mexico, whose expert opinion was called on throughout the conference. LaPaz was absolutely convinced that the green fireballs were not conventional fireballs or meteorites. On the 27th and 28th of April, 1948, Dr. Joseph Kaplan, a member of the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, visited Kirtland Air Force Base Office of Special Investigations, as well as the AEC's Sandia Base at Los Alamos, under orders from Dr. Theodore von Karman, Secretary of the Scientific Advisory Board. The purpose of the visits, a hitherto secret Air Force memorandum states, was to review the reports of investigations and the circumstances surrounding the unidentified aerial phenomenon that had been observed in the area, and to make recommendations as to the advisability of a scientific investigation into the occurrences. Doctors Kaplan and LaPaz met with several security personnel at Los Alamos on the 28th of April, so that Kaplan could try to ascertain the nature of the UFO sightings that had been made there by members of the AEC project and AEC security service inspectors. He seems to have been impressed, and stated that he would immediately submit his report to Dr. von Karman. Dr. Kaplan expressed a great concern, as these occurrences relate to the national defense of the United States. He advised that he felt that this was of extreme importance and should be investigated scientifically. Yet another meeting was convened on the 14th of October, 1949, to discuss the green fireball sightings, and along with earlier delegates was attended by representatives of the 4th Army, Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, FBI, AEC, Geophysical Research Division of Air Materiel Command, and the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. A logical explanation was not proffered with respect to the origin of the green fireballs, an AFOSI confidential memo stated. It was, however, generally concluded that the phenomena existed and that they should be studied scientifically until these occurrences have been satisfactorily explained. Further, that the continued occurrence of unexplained phenomena of this nature in the vicinity of sensitive installations is cause for concern. Of the U.S. Army intelligence representatives present, it is possible that some included members of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit of the Scientific and Technical Branch Counterintelligence Directorate, an elite UFO investigation group allegedly set up by General Marshall in 1947 and disbanded in the 1950s. According to Colonel William Guild, Director of Counterintelligence, all records pertaining to this unit were surrendered to the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations in conjunction with Operation Blue Book. AFOSI have not released these records to date. Did the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit learn some disturbing facts that still cannot be revealed? In 1955, General Douglas MacArthur, also rumored to have been involved in establishing the IPU, made an astonishing statement that lends weight to this possibility. "The nations of the world will have to unite," he said, "for the next war will be an interplanetary war. The nations of the Earth must someday make a common front against attack by people from other planets. Captain Edward Ruppelt, chief of the Aerial Phenomena Branch at Air Technical Intelligence Center and former head of the Air Force's Project Blue Book, reported that in one instance in the summer of 1952, an Air Force jet attempted to shoot down one of the flying saucers. On a certain morning, no date is given, a radar scope near a certain Air Force base picked up an unknown target that approached at 700 miles per hour, then slowed down to a point northeast of the airfield. Two F-86 Sabre jets were scrambled, but at first were unable to locate the target. The second pilot suddenly spotted what at first he took to be a balloon, but a closer view showed that it was definitely saucer-shaped, like a donut without a hole. He began chasing the object and got as close as 500 yards away when it began to accelerate. When it was at a range of 1,000 yards, the machine gun bullets converge at 1,300 yards, he began firing at the target, but it pulled up into a climb and disappeared in seconds. Ruppelt was given this report by an intelligence officer at the base, who said that he had been ordered to burn all copies but had saved one. It is fortunate that the pilot lived to tell the story. Others have not been so lucky. General Benjamin Chidlaw, former commanding general of Air Defense Command, told researcher Robert Gardner in 1953, "We have stacks of reports of flying saucers. We take them seriously when you consider we have lost many men and planes trying to intercept them." If there is any truth to this statement, then the authorities have perfectly understandable reasons for withholding the facts about UFOs from the public. On the 22nd of January 1958, CBS Television presented a program devoted to UFOs on its Armstrong Circle Theater show, and one of those invited to appear was Major Donald Kehoe, director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Several Air Force spokesmen were also scheduled to appear, but insisted on seeing Kehoe's script in advance and asked for assurances that no ad-libs would be permitted. Kehoe was also told that he would be allotted 7 minutes on the program, whereas the Air Force had been given 25 minutes airtime. When Kehoe's material was returned, all the salient points had been deleted on the grounds that the script was too long, despite the fact that he had carefully timed it. But Kehoe had retained one statement, which he planned using. "There is an official policy believed in the best interests of the people not to confirm the existence of UFOs until all the answers are known." Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, former chief of Project Blue Book, has confirmed the existence of four important documents that should be noted. In 1948, in a top-secret estimate, the Air Technical Intelligence Center concluded that UFOs were interplanetary spaceships. In 1952, an Air Force intelligence analysis of UFO maneuvers brought the same conclusion, interplanetary. In January 1953, a report by a panel of top scientists at the Pentagon reached this conclusion: there is strong circumstantial evidence, but no concrete proof that UFOs are spaceships. Kehoe was told that he could not use this statement. The final show was a farce, bearing little relation to the program as originally conceived, with the Air Force spokesman concentrating on some of the sillier stories of contacts with spacemen. By the time Kehoe appeared with his heavily edited script, little could be done to salvage the situation. But in desperation, he suddenly veered from his script on the teleprompter. "And now I'm going to reveal something that has never been disclosed before. For the last 6 months, we have been working with a congressional committee investigating official secrecy about UFOs." But by now, the producer had cut the audio off the air and the public never heard Kehoe's concluding statement. "If all the evidence we have given this committee is made public in open hearings, it will absolutely prove that the UFOs are real machines under intelligent control." NICAP later obtained a statement from the CBS director of editing, Herbert A. Carlborg, which proves that Major Kehoe was cut off the air in the interests of security. "This program had been carefully screened for security reasons," he said. "Therefore, it was the responsibility of this network to ensure performance that was in accordance with predetermined security standards. Any indication that there would be a deviation from the script might lead to a statement that neither this network nor the individuals on the program were authorized to release." Stories of encounters with the occupants of UFOs are invariably greeted with a barrage of ridicule, particularly if the witnesses claim to have met beings similar to ourselves in appearance. The case of Sid Padrick deserves attention, not least because the witness was asked by the Air Force not to discuss certain details. At 2 a.m. on the 30th of January, 1965, radio TV technician Padrick, 45 years old at the time, encountered a landed UFO near his home at Manresa Beach near Watsonville, 75 miles south of San Francisco. He saw an unlit craft some 70 feet in diameter and 30 feet high, like two real thick saucers inverted, approach him and come to rest just above the ground. He panicked, began to run, then heard a voice coming from the craft. "Do not be frightened. We are not hostile," it said. Padrick ran further. The voice repeated the phrase, then added, "We mean you no harm," and invited him on board. As he cautiously approached the craft, a door opened and he went inside, finding himself in a small compartment about 6 by 7 feet. Another door slid open and he entered, to be met by a man. He was no different than me in basic appearance, had clean-cut features, and wore a type of flying suit that covered the body fully, said Padrick. On board were another 7 men, similar in appearance, and 1 woman described as extremely pretty. They were all about 5 feet 8 inches to 5 feet 9 inches tall. Each of the rooms that was occupied had instrument panels on the walls, with the crew members concentrating on the instruments. They merely glanced around at me when I entered the room, then turned back to their work as if they were unconcerned, said Padrick. After a while, the spaceman told Padrick that they had traveled some distance and were now parked in a deserted area, which on subsequent investigation turned out to be near Leggett, California, 175 miles northwest of Watsonville. Padrick asked where the craft and its people came from and received a somewhat cryptic reply. He told me they were from a planet in back of a planet which we observe, but we do not observe them. He did not say that we couldn't observe them, he merely said we didn't observe them. I think their planet is in our solar system. The spaceman described his utopian society to Padrick. "As you know it, we have no sickness. We have no crimes. We have no police force. We have no schools. Our young are taught at an early age to do a job which they do very well. Because of our long life expectancy, we have a very strict birth control. We have no money. We live as one." Padrick asked what the purpose of the visit was. The man replied, "Observation only." Sid Padrick reported his experience to the Air Force and was grilled for 3 hours by a team headed by Major D.B. Reeder of Hamilton Air Force Base. "They tried to frighten me. They said, 'Mr. Padrick, you are a real lucky person. These craft that come down here are real hostile, and you had no business even approaching them.' I disagreed with them, because when this craft came down, they did not want to frighten me. They did not tell me to go aboard their craft. They invited me aboard." The Air Force told Padrick that there was more than one group of UFOs visiting Earth, and that there were friendly as well as hostile craft from more than one source. There were certain details the Air Force asked me not to talk about publicly, but I think in telling it that everything should be disclosed. I can see no reason for anything being held back. They didn't want me to say that the space people had no money. They didn't want me to disclose the type and shape of the craft, because that would indicate that the Air Force is not doing its duty. I told them I could see no reason for that either. Mysterious men dressed in Air Force uniform or bearing impressive credentials from government agencies who intimidate witnesses and sometimes confiscate evidence from them have now become inextricably enmeshed in UFO lore. In 1967, even the Air Force was obliged to acknowledge that such incidents took place, but denied any involvement. These men are not connected with the Air Force, said Colonel George Freeman, Pentagon spokesman for Project Blue Book. Perhaps Colonel Freeman was telling the truth and was genuinely unaware of government involvement in these incidents. Owing to compartmentation of intelligence, he may not have had a need to know about the investigations, nor would he necessarily have known which agency was involved. And if he did, it would hardly have been in the government's best interest to admit as much. The Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI, with a long history of involvement in the clandestine UFO investigations, might have been responsible, as could NORAD itself. There are other factors to be taken into consideration. The CIA, for example, is not above using agents posing as Air Force officers when the occasion demands. They don't go around wearing CIA badges. During a talk given to the Tulsa, Oklahoma Astronomy Club in 1982, former Air Force intelligence officer Steve Lewis revealed that the 12 years he spent investigating UFOs for the military, both in the U.S. and abroad, convinced him that intelligent extraterrestrial beings are visiting Earth. Apologizing for being unable to be more specific owing to strict orders from the Air Force not to divulge specific details about his UFO research from 1965 to 1977, including a period with Project Blue Book, Lewis stated that only a fraction of information accumulated by the military has been released. He admitted that although the majority of sightings have a mundane explanation, the bona fide reports are often associated with a common feature of very bright, blinding lights. The Air Force believes that the light may be related to an advanced propulsion system, enabling UFOs to travel at the speed of light, Lewis said. Pressed to reveal what had convinced him that UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft rather than top-secret military devices, Lewis commented, "The records, the information I saw while in my job. I no longer rule out what the possibilities might be." America's highly secret Defense Intelligence Agency was established in 1961 by Robert McNamara, President Kennedy's defense secretary. The DIA's mandate was to coordinate all U.S. military intelligence services, those of the Air Force, Army, and Navy. This upset not only these individual services, but also the CIA, who perceived the DIA as a serious rival, since the strength of the combined military services intelligence branches exceeded that of the CIA. The DIA works for the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Director of Central Intelligence, and is staffed by both military officers and civilians. Its employees are said to number 7,000, and its budget in the 1970s was estimated at $100 million per annum. In addition to processing and analyzing intelligence gathered from military sources, which is then turned into finished intelligence reports that are circulated within the Pentagon and the intelligence community, the DIA prepares daily and weekly intelligence digests, as well as its own estimates of enemy capabilities. In 1979, the DIA had submitted a motion to the U.S. Attorney indicating that they had searched their complete record systems and had no documents on UFOs other than three that they had found and released. In view of the DIA's denials that they had any further material on UFOs, it is interesting that in December 1985, the agency released a total of 37 UFO-related documents, amounting to 139 pages, to researcher Ray Bosch. In their covering letter to Bosch, the DIA explained that it has been determined that there are 53 documents responsive to your FOIA request. Of these 53 documents, portions of 15 are properly classified and are not releasable. Some of the released documents, stamped best copy available, are barely legible. The earliest dates back to 1957, which is curious since the DIA was founded in 1961. Most probably, the earlier reports were later forwarded to the DIA by the relevant service intelligence agencies. The legibility on some of the documents is due either to the fact that the DIA considered them so insignificant that they were not worth preserving in legible form, or that they have been made deliberately illegible. It is evident from some of the documents that the primary concern of the DIA or submitting agencies was sightings related to Soviet activity. Of the 139 pages of DIA documents now released, four contain intriguing references to Project Moondust. This project was, and possibly still is, a foreign space debris program of the U.S. Air Force System Command's Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. And while its primary function would seem to be the recovery of missile and satellite debris, there are indications that it has also been involved in the recovery of more exotic artifacts. A UFO sighting over Agadir, Morocco, on the 11th and 12th of January, 1967, for example, led to translations of two articles being sent to the DIA by the U.S. defense attaché in Rabat, who commented, The Page One coverage afforded this sighting demonstrates a high level of local interest in the subject of UFOs and presages future reporting which could be valuable in pursuit of Project Moondust. Another UFO report from Morocco a couple of months later gave Project Moondust as its reference. Ray Bosch has subsequently uncovered further information about the project, having filed a number of Freedom of Information requests with the CIA, DIA, Department of Defense, National Security Council, and Air Force. Ray informed me that Project Moondust was definitely UFO-related, but no really significant documents have been released to him so far. The extent of the DIA's interest in UFO reports can be demonstrated by its efficiency in collecting news cuttings on the subject, and a wave of sightings in Argentina from June to August 1968 led to the defense attaché in Buenos Aires, Colonel Charles Greffet, forwarding no less than 23 news clippings to the Pentagon. It could be argued that the DIA is merely the world's most expensive news clipping agency, or that its only concern is with UFO reports that relate to hostile foreign aircraft or missiles. While it is obvious that mundane intelligence gathering is the DIA's primary function, many reports, such as the following summaries, reflect a concern with more exotic UFOs. Buenos Aires, the 8th of June, 68, describes how two experienced pilots, 22 and 13 years with Aerolíneas Argentinas, saw a UFO while flying over Punta Arenas. Cordoba, the 5th of July, 68, outlines details on the invention of a geomagnetic and light detector to warn of the presence of UFOs. Second article, same source, quotes Argentine Commander-in-Chief of Navy as suggesting that Argentine armed forces are participating in an investigation of UFOs. Tandil, the 13th of July, 68, describes landing of a UFO at the Air Force Base at Tandil. Buenos Aires, the 26th of July, 68, describes attempt by five policemen in Olavarria to capture and later shoot three crew members of UFO. Buenos Aires, the 27th of July, 68, relates new sighting near La Pastora Alvear and Tapalque. The latter describes the crew and inability of machine gun bullets to affect them. La Razón, 3rd of August, 68, relates argument by a Professor Alexander Ayrou supporting theory of flying saucers. Colonel Greffet comments, "It is significant to note that a state of concern exists among the population in many parts of Argentina." Despite some obviously significant reports, the DIA has not released any worthwhile analyses. This is probably at the request of the Director of Central Intelligence, who, in addition to being head of the CIA, manages the entire community of intelligence agencies throughout the U.S. government. Admiral Stansfield Turner, Director of Central Intelligence, DCI, during the Carter administration, is scathing about the DIA's analytic product, however, which he describes as well below the caliber of the rest of the intelligence community. Admiral Turner also points out that the CIA's analytic work competes with that of the DIA and other intelligence agencies, and leaves us in no doubt that the CIA is superior in this respect. Unlike the CIA, the DIA cannot present its analysis directly to the National Security Council, although the Secretary of Defense can, if he chooses, present DIA estimates that differ from those of the CIA. Of course, neither agency is prepared to release its analyses of the UFO phenomenon, so we are forced to draw our own conclusions from the released documents. Perhaps we should be grateful for these. At the same time, the DIA denied for years that they possessed any documents on UFOs other than those few they released in the late 1970s, further evidence that governments worldwide are reluctant to acknowledge their serious concern with the ubiquitous UFO phenomenon. The Central Intelligence Agency was formed with Britain's help out of the Office of Strategic Services in the Central Intelligence Group in 1947. It has an estimated annual budget of $1 billion. The CIA is divided into four directorates: the Directorate of Science and Technology, the Directorate of Administration, the Directorate of Intelligence, and the Directorate of Operations. Above these four directorates is the National Intelligence Council, formerly the Intelligence Resources Advisory Committee, which coordinates the various methods of intelligence gathering according to the priorities assigned to the requests that are presented to it. At the same level of authority are the National Intelligence Officers who prepare the National Intelligence Estimates, which go to the National Security Council and sometimes to the President. According to Todd Zetchel, a former employee of the National Security Agency, All four directorates of the CIA have been engaged in collecting, analyzing, and suppressing UFO data since 1948. Zetchel claims that the National Photographic Interpretation Center, established within the Directorate of Science and Technology in 1953, has been analyzing all UFO photographic data, and the Office of Scientific Intelligence, as it was then called, has been analyzing worldwide UFO data since its inception, including non-photographic cases, physical evidence, and secondary analysis of photographic cases. Zetchel further claims that domestic reports were collected by the CIA from the Air Force via the Pentagon's Office of Current Intelligence and from other intelligence agencies such as the NSA and Defense Intelligence Agency via links with their communications networks. Domestic reports have been collected from the CIA's Domestic Operations Division, Domestic Collection Division offices in cities throughout the United States, Zetchel maintains. Foreign reports were collected by the National Foreign Assessment Center via the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, the Office of Current Intelligence, and the Office of Operations, as these departments were called until the 1970s. Zetchel also makes the disturbing claim that agents of the CIA's Directorate of Operations have interrogated UFO witnesses and that agents of the Domestic Operations Division have been involved in harassing, intimidating, and even silencing witnesses. On the 2nd of December, 1952, H. Marshall Chadwell, Assistant Director of Scientific Intelligence, sent a secret memorandum to the CIA director discussing the preparation of the National Security Council directive referred to earlier. Recent reports reaching CIA indicated that further action was desirable, and another briefing by the Cognizant Air Force Intelligence and Air Technical Intelligence Center personnel was held on the 25th of November. At this time, the reports of incidents convince us that there is something going on that must have immediate attention. Sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes and traveling at high speeds in the vicinity of major U.S. defense installations are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. The situation had evidently become so worrying for the CIA by the end of 1952 that a panel of scientists was convened by the Office of Scientific Intelligence, and the secret meetings were held at the Pentagon from the 14th to the 17th of January 1953. Members of the scientific advisory panel were Dr. H.P. Robertson, Dr. Luis Alvarez, Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner, Dr. Samuel Gutsmith, and Dr. Thornton Page. The associate members were Dr. J. Allen Hynek and Frederick C. Durant. One of the panel's recommendations was that a policy of debunking UFO reports should be instituted. The debunking aim would result in reduction in public interest in flying saucers, which today evokes a strong psychological reaction. This education could be accomplished by mass media such as television, motion pictures, and popular articles. Basis of such education would be actual case histories, which had been puzzling at first but later explained. As is the case of conjuring tricks, there is much less stimulation if the secret is known. Such a program should tend to reduce the current gullibility of the public and consequently their susceptibility to clever hostile propaganda. The panel noted that the general absence of Russian propaganda based on a subject with so many obvious possibilities for exploitation might indicate a possible Russian official policy. The panel discussed the various insidious methods that could be implemented to execute such a program. It was felt strongly that psychologists familiar with mass psychology should advise on the nature and extent of the program, the report states, and three specific psychologists were suggested as consultants. Documentary films and cartoons, Walt Disney Incorporated being recommended for the latter, were proposed, and it was believed that business clubs, high schools, colleges, and television stations would all be pleased to cooperate in the showing of documentary-type motion pictures if prepared in an interesting manner. The use of true cases showing first the mystery and then the explanation would be forceful. Dr. Allen Hynek suggested that amateur astronomers in the U.S. might be a potential source of enthusiastic talent to spread the gospel. Another sinister recommendation of the panel was that civilian UFO groups should be watched because of their potentially great influence on mass thinking if widespread sightings should occur. The apparent irresponsibility and the possible use of such groups for subversive purposes should be kept in mind. The panel concluded that the continued emphasis on the reporting of these phenomena does, in this parlous times, result in a threat to the orderly functioning of the protective organs of the body politic, and recommended that the national security agencies take immediate steps to strip the unidentified flying objects of the special status they have been given and the aura of mystery they have unfortunately acquired. That the national security agencies institute policies on intelligence, training, and public education designed to prepare the material defenses and the morale of the country to recognize most promptly and to react most effectively to true indications of hostile intent or action. We suggest that these aims may be achieved by an integrated program designed to reassure the public of the total lack of evidence of inimical forces behind the phenomena, to train personnel to recognize and reject false indications quickly and effectively, and to strengthen regular channels for the evaluation of and prompt reaction to true indications of hostile measures. Freelance journalist Warren Smith relates a rather sinister encounter with alleged CIA agents in the 1970s when he was coerced into handing over a piece of metal that he had acquired from a farmer who had discovered some fragments after witnessing a UFO hovering over his orchard in Wisconsin. Word got around about the incident, and the farmer reported being subsequently visited by a fertilizer salesman who seemed more interested in learning about the samples than selling fertilizer. The farmer informed the salesman that he had given one of the pieces to Smith. The salesman told the farmer that he was staying in a motel and suggested that it might be the same one as Smith. When the latter learned of this, he tied the piece of metal to the inside of his motel room's television set at the Holiday Inn, Madison, as a precaution. Within one day, I was the most popular person in Madison, particularly when I was out, said Smith. I asked the maids and motel maintenance man to watch my room during my absence. Two men with a room key were moving in as soon as I left. One maid had the courage to enter the room on the pretense of checking it for cleanliness. She excused herself when she saw the two men going through my suitcase. When Smith visited the farmer again, he learned that two men in Air Force uniforms had persuaded him to part with his metal fragment, citing national security, a danger to the world, and the government's desire to have that fragment of metal as the reasons. On Smith's return to the motel, the two men were waiting, one stretched out on the bed and the other sitting at the desk. After an exchange of false pleasantries, one of the men said, "You have something we want. A farmer gave you a piece of metal the other day. Our job is to pick it up." Smith prevaricated for as long as possible, pretending that he had sent the fragment to someone else, but the men began to threaten him, warning that he should think of his wife, children, and career. Smith asked for identification. "Name the agency and we'll produce it," they replied. Smith finally agreed to give them the piece of metal on condition that they answered a few questions, and the conversation was continued over coffee at the motel restaurant. The men refused to answer questions, of course, but before leaving revealed that UFOs involve more than you or any civilian can realize. They're the most important thing and perhaps the greatest hazard that mankind has ever faced. In 1979, Victor Marchetti, former executive assistant to the deputy director and special assistant to the executive director of the CIA, stated that during his time in the agency, UFOs were not normally discussed because the subject came under the area of very sensitive activities. From the very beginning, in 1947, the CIA has closely monitored UFO reports on a worldwide basis, although most of the Freedom of Information Act documents indicate only a routine interest in the problem, which was handled largely by the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, Foreign Documents Division, and the Domestic Contact Service, all innocuous, non-clandestine units. They also disclose, by inference, a standing requirement of the Directorate of Science and Technology for gathering UFO data. This, in turn, indicates other collection units, says Marchetti, such as the clandestine services, the CIA's directorate, which was given the task of providing information from all over the world on the UFO phenomenon. However, he adds, few such reports were released, and that implies a cover-up. His theory is that we have indeed been contacted, perhaps even visited, by extraterrestrial beings, and that the U.S. government, in collusion with the other national powers of the earth, is determined to keep this information from the general public. The purpose of the international conspiracy is to maintain a workable stability among the nations of the world and for them, in turn, to retain institutional control over their respective populations. Thus, for these governments to admit that there are beings from outer space, with mentalities and technological capabilities obviously far superior to ours, could, once fully perceived by the average person, erode the foundation of the Earth's traditional power structure. Political and legal systems, religions, economic and social institutions could all soon become meaningless in the mind of the public. The national oligarchical establishments, even civilization as we know it, could collapse into anarchy. Such extreme conclusions are not necessarily valid, but they probably accurately reflect the fears of the ruling classes of the major nations, whose leaders, particularly those in the intelligence business, have always advocated excessive governmental secrecy as being necessary to preserve national security. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, established in 1958, coordinates and directs the Aeronautical and Space Research Program in the United States. Its budget for space activities alone is larger than the general budgets of a number of the world's important countries. Although officially a civilian agency, NASA collaborates with the CIA, Department of Defense, National Reconnaissance Office, National Security Agency, and other agencies, and many of its personnel have high security clearances owing to the sensitive intelligence aspects of many of its programs. Research into UFOs is one such program. In 1967, NASA Management Instruction established procedures for handling reports of sightings of objects such as fragments or component parts of space vehicles known or alleged by an observer to have impacted upon the Earth's surface as a result of safety destruct action, failure in flight, or re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere, and also includes reports of sightings of objects not related to space vehicles. A rather euphemistic way of putting it, to be sure, but the internal instruction continues, "It is Kennedy Space Center policy to respond to reported sightings of space vehicle fragments and unidentified flying objects as promptly as possible. Under no circumstances will the origin of the object be discussed with the observer or person making the call." A 1978 NASA information sheet gives the agency's official policy on the subject. NASA is the focal point for answering public inquiries to the White House relating to UFOs. NASA is not engaged in a research program involving these phenomena, nor is any other government agency. Reports of unidentified objects entering United States airspace are of interest to the military as a regular part of defense surveillance. Beyond that, the U.S. Air Force no longer investigates reports of UFO sightings. During his election campaign in 1976, Jimmy Carter revealed that he had seen a UFO at Leary, Georgia in 1969, together with witnesses, prior to giving a speech at the local Lions Club. "If I become president," Carter vowed, "I'll make every piece of information this country has about UFO sightings available to the public and the scientists." Although President Carter did all he could to fulfill his election pledge, he was thwarted, and it is clear that NASA had a hand in blocking his attempts to reopen investigations. When Carter's science advisor Dr. Frank Press wrote to NASA Administrator Dr. Robert Frosch in February 1977, suggesting that NASA should become the focal point for the UFO question, Dr. Frosch replied that although he was prepared to continue responding to public inquiries, he proposed that NASA take no steps to establish a research activity in this area or to convene a symposium on this subject. In a letter from Colonel Charles Senn, Chief of the Air Force Community Relations Division, to Lieutenant General Deward Crow of NASA, dated the 1st of September 1977, Colonel Senn made the following astonishing statement: "I sincerely hope that you are successful in preventing a reopening of UFO investigations." So it is clear that NASA, as well as the Air Force and almost certainly the CIA and National Security Agency, was anxious to ensure that the president's election pledge remained unfulfilled. According to hitherto unconfirmed reports, both Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin saw a UFO shortly after that historic landing on the moon in Apollo 11 on 21st of July 1969. According to former NASA employee Otto Binder, unnamed radio hams with their own VHF receiving facilities that bypassed NASA's broadcasting outlets picked up the following exchange. Mission Control: "What's there?" Mission Control calling Apollo 11. Apollo 11: "These babies are huge, sir. Enormous. Oh, God, you wouldn't believe it. I'm telling you, there are other spacecraft out there, lined up on the far side of the crater edge. They're on the moon, watching us. The story has been relegated to the world of science fiction since it first appeared, but in 1979, Maurice Chatelain, former chief of NASA communications specialist and one of the scientists who conceived and designed the Apollo spacecraft, confirmed that Armstrong had indeed reported two UFOs on the rim of the crater. The encounter was common knowledge in NASA, he revealed, but nobody has talked about it until now. But is there any truth to the Apollo 11 story? A certain professor was engaged in an earnest discussion with Neil Armstrong during a NASA symposium, and according to my friend's recollection, part of the conversation went as follows. Professor, what really happened out there with Apollo 11? Armstrong, it was incredible. Of course, we had always known that there was a possibility. The fact is, we were warned off. There was never any question then of a space station or a moon city. Professor, how do you mean warned off? Armstrong, I can't go into details except to say that their ships were far superior to ours both in size and technology. Boy, were they big and menacing. No, there is no question of a space station. Professor, but NASA had other missions after Apollo 11. Armstrong, naturally, NASA was committed at that time and couldn't risk a panic on Earth, but it really was a quick scoop and back again. Later, when my friend confronted Armstrong, the latter confirmed that the story was true but refused to go into further detail beyond admitting that the CIA was behind the cover-up. What does Neil Armstrong have to say about the matter officially? In reply to my inquiry, he simply stated, "Your reliable sources are unreliable. There were no objects reported, found, or seen on Apollo 11 or any other Apollo flight other than of natural origin. All observations on all Apollo flights were fully reported to the public." It was the columnist Frank Scully who first alerted the world to sensational stories of recovered flying saucers and little men in his best-selling book, Behind the Flying Saucers, published in 1950. Scully claimed that up to that time, there had been four such recoveries, one of which was alleged to have taken place near Aztec, New Mexico, when 16 humanoid bodies were recovered together with their undamaged craft. The story sounds ridiculous and is widely dismissed with the others as a hoax perpetrated on Scully, and has been the butt of endless jokes ever since. But there is a great deal more to this particular story than has been hitherto supposed. According to Scully's informants, the disc that landed near Aztec was 99.99 feet in diameter. Its exterior made of a light metal resembling aluminum, but so durable that no amount of heat, up to 10,000 degrees, was applied, or diamond-tip drilling had the slightest effect. The disc apparently incorporated large rings of metal which revolved around a central stabilized cabin, using an unfamiliar gear ratio. There were no rivets, bolts, screws, or signs of welding. Investigators were eventually able to gain entry, Scully was told, because of a fracture in one of the portholes, which they enlarged, revealing a knob inside the cabin which, when pushed with a pole, caused a hidden door to open. 16 small humanoids, ranging in height from 36 to 42 inches, were supposedly found dead inside the cabin, their bodies charred to a dark brown color. Scully was told that the craft was undamaged, having landed under its own guidance. The craft was eventually dismantled, the investigators having discovered that it was manufactured in segments which fitted in grooves and were pinned together around the base. The complete cabin section, measuring 18 feet in diameter, was lifted out of the base of the saucer, around which was a gear that fitted a gear on the cabin. These segments, together with the bodies, were then transported to Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Some of the bodies were later dissected and examined by the Air Force and were found to be similar in all respects to human beings, with the exception of their teeth, which were perfect. This, then, is one of the incredible stories of recovered discs related to Scully, who stood by its authenticity for the rest of his life and never revealed the names of his sources despite large cash inducements. But is there any truth to it? According to important information published by William Steinman in 1987, there is a large grain of truth in the Aztec story, and he has managed to acquire some quite astonishing supportive evidence. Steinman has discovered that the Aztec disc came to Earth on the 25th of March, 1948. The area of impact was calculated by triangulation, and this information was immediately relayed to Air Defense Command and General George C. Marshall, then Secretary of State, who allegedly contacted the MJ-12 group as well as the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit of the Army's Counterintelligence Directorate. The IPU operated out of Camp Hale, Colorado at this time, Steinman claims, and its main function was to collect and deliver disabled or crashed disks to certain specified secret locations. The craft was recovered within hours by the IPU scout team about 12 miles northeast of Aztec. General Marshall ordered Air Defense Command to go off alert status, and the radar stations were advised that there had been a false alarm. Marshall then gave orders to the commander of the IPU to organize a recovery team and contacted Dr. Vannevar Bush, the head of MJ-12, to gather together a team of scientists to accompany the IPU to the crash site. Steinman has named these scientists as follows: Dr. Lloyd Berkner, Dr. Detlef Bronk, Dr. Carl A. Hyland, Dr. Jerome Hunsaker, Dr. John von Neumann, Dr. Robert J. Oppenheimer, Dr. Merle A. Tuve, and Dr. Horace B. Van Valkenburg. The team of scientists arrived at the site a little later than the IPU team and began inspecting the disk. According to Steinman, they entered the craft one by one, entry having been gained via a fractured porthole as described in Scully's account. The portholes themselves looked metallic and only appeared translucent on close inspection. Inside the cabin, they found two humanoids, about 4 feet in height, slumped over an instrument panel, charred deep brown. Another 12 bodies lay sprawled on the floor in a chamber within the cabin, making a total of 14 bodies, not 16 as Scully had been told. An instrument panel supposedly had several push buttons and levers with hieroglyphic-type symbols, as well as symbols illuminated on small display screens. Bush and von Neumann discovered that the control panel had drawers which rolled out, but no wiring could be detected. A book, composed of parchment-like leaves with the texture of plastic, also contained the strange hieroglyphs, similar to Sanskrit, Oppenheimer thought. This was given to General Marshall, who then passed it on to two leading cryptological experts for analysis, William F. Friedman and Lambro C. Callejamos, who both later led distinguished careers in the National Security Agency. Dr. Bronk, a physiologist and biophysicist, examined the bodies and asked Bush to get hold of cryogenic equipment with which to preserve them. Cryogenic specialist Dr. Paul A. Shearer, a colleague of Bush's, was contacted and advised Bush to obtain some dry ice. Meanwhile, another small group of scientists and military personnel examined the craft and were eventually able to dismantle it when several interlocking key devices were found which opened up seams at specific points. 3 days later, the segments were loaded onto three trucks, together with the bodies, and were covered with a tarpaulin marked explosives. The convoy headed at night by the least conspicuous and often most laborious route to the restricted Navy Auxiliary Airfield complex at Los Alamos, arriving 1 week later. Here they remained for over a year, Steinman claims, before being transported to another base. The most convincing evidence that Scully's claims are fundamentally sound has been provided by the Canadian government scientist Wilbert Smith, who stated in a 1950 top-secret document that the subject of flying saucers was classified higher than the H-bomb, and that their modus operandi is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Smith's informant was Dr. Robert Sarbacher, a consultant to the Research and Development Board, and in his handwritten notes made after the interview, Smith recorded the following, dated the 15th of September, 1950. Smith: I have read Scully's book on the saucers and would like to know how much of it is true. Sarbacher: The facts reported in the book are substantially correct. Smith: Then the saucers do exist? Sarbacher: Yes, they exist. Smith: I understand the whole subject is classified. Sarbacher: Yes, it is classified 2 points higher even than the H-bomb. In fact, it is the most highly classified subject in the U.S. government at the present time. Smith: May I ask the reason for the classification? Sarbacher: You may ask, but I can't tell you. Founded in 1952 under President Truman, America's vast national security agency has grown into the world's largest eavesdropping empire, with an estimated annual budget in 1985 of $2 billion. Based in 1,000 acres at Fort George Meade, Maryland, the NSA has its own college, 18,000 students at the last count, its own power station, television station and studio, and a total of 50,000 personnel. In 1982, the sensational book by James Bamford, The Puzzle Palace, revealed a wealth of hitherto secret information about the NSA, an agency so secret that it was sometimes referred to as no such agency. There is not one single reference to the subject of UFOs, however. Until recently, few outside the intelligence community had the slightest hint of NSA involvement with UFOs. Thanks to Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, 18 documents on UFOs originating with the NSA were admitted during litigation against the CIA. Lawyer Peter Gersten filed a request under the Freedom of Information Act for their release, but was informed that the documents were exempt from disclosure in the interests of national security. After another unsuccessful attempt under the Freedom of Information Act to obtain the documents, Gersten eventually succeeded in securing the release of two documents in January 1980. The NSA admitted that other documents on UFOs were being withheld, in addition to the original 18, and that a further 79 documents were being referred to other originating agencies for review. Later that year, NSA Representative Eugene Yates admitted in a court hearing that the NSA had found a total of 239 documents on UFOs that were relevant to the FOIA request. Following another refusal to release more documents, Peter Gersten filed suit against the NSA on behalf of Citizens Against UFO Secrecy in the District Court, Washington, D.C., in the spring of 1980 to obtain the 135 documents then admitted to being withheld by the agency. Judge Gessel studied a 21-page NSA affidavit in camera and ruled that the agency was fully justified in withholding the documents in their entirety. The in-camera affidavit was itself classified at a level above top secret. Of 502 lines in the affidavit, 412 are totally or partially deleted. While I am all in favor of the NSA protecting its intelligence acquiring capability, I find it difficult to accept that the deleted portions relate exclusively to these matters. Why did the NSA not produce any of these documents for the judge to examine, as is customary in a dispute on whether material is properly classified? While working with the NSA in 1964, Todd Zetchel saw messages transmitted from the Air Force Special Security Service, an NSA USAF subsidiary, to the CIA's Special Security Office, a CIA cover within NSA's communications network. The transmissions were radar plottings of a UFO flying in an erratic manner near the border of a certain country, which had been picked up by a reconnaissance plane during a tracking mission. Zetchel assumes that the CIA had issued instructions to the NSA to report on all UFOs it tracked. The fact that the messages were being routed to the CIA station certainly indicates a prior arrangement to do so, he believes. I think it would be safe to assume that the CIA, which worked closely with the Air Force Special Security anyway, had instructed the unit to keep them informed of any sightings. While the NSA claims that the deletions in its above-top-secret affidavit relate solely to the protection of its intelligence-gathering capabilities, I feel certain that it is only half the truth. By July 1947, when sightings proliferated throughout the United States and a disc crashed at Roswell, New Mexico, it must have become obvious that the flying saucers were of extraterrestrial origin. Apart from the fact that an admission to this effect would generate public alarm, the military needed to learn as much as possible about the construction and propulsion of the craft in the event that another nation, particularly the Soviet Union, might acquire this knowledge first, hence another reason for absolute secrecy attached to the investigations. No government is happy to admit that alien vehicles invading airspace can come and go as they please, and that defense against them is inadequate. That some UFOs have been responsible for the disappearance and even destruction of aircraft is not something that could be admitted openly. I have documented several such alarming incidents, as well as quoting General Benjamin Chidlaw's private express statement in 1953 that we have lost many men and planes trying to intercept them. As a head of U.S. Continental Air Defense at the time, he presumably knew what he was talking about. Public reaction to an admission by one of the superpowers that some UFOs are extraterrestrial would be predicated on how much we are told, and this must present our leaders with an awesome dilemma. Such an admission would lead to a deluge of questions, some of which simply cannot be answered without disclosing vital defense interests, alarming cases of missing aircraft, abductions, genetic experiments, and bizarre cases that will remain beyond our comprehension for centuries to come. In this respect, I am fully in sympathy with the current official policy. From an intelligence point of view, says Dr. James Harder, the UFO phenomenon must be truly awesome, the worst of science fiction come to life. However, over the years, the intelligence agencies must have come to the realization that the strangers from space are nothing exactly new, that evidence from the past indicates that we are experiencing only an intensification of what may have been going on for centuries. The effects on the economic and political front are equally deserving of consideration. Every nation is concerned about the effects on worldwide economies and political power structures if the world were to be in touch with aliens with a different technology, Stanton Friedman believes. Is the oil in the ground now worthless? Would the big shots of today be deposed tomorrow? The best policy is to hope that the aliens go away, or that the contacts and shakings up of earthly society happen during the next administration's reign. There are many hypotheses for the origin of UFOs, other than the extraterrestrial one. Secret aircraft and spacecraft, natural phenomena, a secret civilization based on Earth, time travelers from our own future, which is good news since it presupposes that we have a future, denizens of other dimensions, or psychological projections. Regarding the latter, a miasma of psychological and sociological hypotheses has been proposed to account for UFO sightings. None of these theories comes anywhere near explaining all the facts. The extraterrestrial hypothesis may not fulfill this requirement, but it is the only one that explains most of the facts. There are about 100,000 million stars in our galaxy alone. To put that figure into perspective, it would take almost 3,000 years to count those stars at the rate of 1 per second. Many of the stars are likely to have planets around them, on some of which life may have evolved to the extent that space travel and colonization are commonplace. Since I do not know where the visitors come from, I can only speculate as to their origin, although I've been informed by reliable sources that some of them may have bases within our solar system, even here on Earth. Neither do I know why they are here, although I can think of numerous reasons for their visits. From a tourist point of view, for example, Earth offers some spectacular attractions. A vested interest in Earth and its resources, unique in the solar system, is another more probable reason. We are not here for entirely philanthropic purposes, my most reliable source of information was told. I believe that man's progress on planet Earth has been monitored by beings whose technological and mental resources make ours look primitive, and theirs supernatural by comparison. The fact that many of the visitors are similar to us physiologically indicates that we share a genetic link. Could it be that some of them have had a hand in our evolution? Now that our technology has reached the stage where we are endangering the planet and expanding our interest in space, surveillance has intensified. Is it mere coincidence that the modern wave of sightings began during World War II as we began developing nuclear weapons and rockets? Is it also coincidental that UFOs have exhibited so much interest in our nuclear missile sites and have demonstrated their ability to paralyze launching systems? We have learned to live, however uneasily, with the threat of nuclear annihilation hanging over us like the sword of Damocles. Surely nothing that governments are concealing about UFOs can compare with this prospect. The intelligence community should be reminded that they are accountable to the Congress, that even if certain matters affecting national security simply cannot be revealed, we are entitled to know some of the truth at least. The public has a right to know, declared former CIA Director Admiral Hillen Carter in 1960. It is time for the truth to be brought out in open congressional hearings. Through official secrecy and ridicule, many citizens are led to believe the unknown flying objects are nonsense. Nearly 30 years later, we are still being misled. Until we wake up to the fact that information of quite unprecedented significance is being withheld from us, we shall continue to remain in ignorance for decades to come. Unless, that is, the visitors decide to declare themselves more openly.